Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. After being savaged by Saturday Night Live, Trump tweeted, "A real scandal is the one-sided coverage hour by hour of networks like NBC. We'll open the lines and ask you, is he right? With an unprecedented president like Trump in these highly divisive times, is any coverage of him not one-sided?" Then Governor Michael Dukakis joins us for his take on the future of the Democratic Party, his tireless advocacy for the North-South rail link, and how politics has changed since he ran against George H.W. Bush.
At noon, Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell is here to talk public schools, public safety, and if we've got a diversity problem when it comes to the recreational marijuana industry. And is it time to hit the Patriots' panic button? After Sunday's loss to the Steelers, can Tom beat time to bring the team to the Super Bowl? Trenny Kuznarek weighs in. That's next on Boston Public Radio. And you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It is Tuesday. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hey, Jim.
Hi there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So good. So it's become a weekend ritual. Saturday Night Live does a number of sketches at Trump's expense, fueling his early Sunday morning tweets where he lashes out at them. In response to SNL's latest Trump takedown, the president tweeted this: "A real scandal is the one-sided coverage, hour by hour, of networks like NBC and Democrat spin machines like SNL. It's all nothing less than unfair news coverage, and Democratic commercials should be tested in court. Can't be legal. Only defame and belittle. Collusion." And, of course, there is relentless criticism on Twitter of CNN. So if you're Donald Trump, then, yes, any negative coverage will seem one-sided. After all, when you have a president who might be going to jail if being president weren't protecting him from being indicted, how fair should the media coverage be? Nonetheless, does Trump have a point? Isn't everything now one-sided? Right now on Fox, for example, the lead story is Trump holds firm on border wall. On CNN, it's James Comey's chilling warning to Trump. If the media are having a hard time not being one-sided, how about you? Are you able to get fair and balanced coverage anywhere? If so, where? And in these extreme times, though, is it okay to have extreme coverage? Our number is 877-301-8970. This is not what you're supposed to do on talk radio, but I'm going to do it right now. I'm going to come down firmly on both sides of this
good.
Issue.
Okay.
On the one hand, Trump has a point, by the way. CNN, which, you know, is our network of choice, yours and mine, It is a relentless anti-Trump thing, is it not? I mean, Don Lemon is probably the worst, you know, weeping at 10 o'clock when he's doing the crossover with his brother, Chris Cuomo. I mean, even Anderson Cooper, who I love, who I think is the most balanced of them all. Well, John King is actually the most balanced, but I'm talking about prime time. They cross the line. I think a lot of these reporters tweeting nonstop, not editorialists, but reporters from credible newspapers tweeting nonstop are crossing the line. But on the flip side, you know what I'm thinking about this weekend? When I'm reading the tweet that has two lies in it, remember there was a whole debate about whether or not reporters, journalists should use the word lie, when Trump's tweeting about the illegal appointment of the special counsel, And I can't remember what the other the break-in, which it was not, of course, into Michael Cohen's office. I'm saying to myself, has he so crossed the line that it's okay for reporters to be doing things they never did before? And so the answer is, I guess it depends on the issue. Sometimes I think traditional, responsible, mainstream media is going too far. On the other hand, sometimes I feel like even I... You know, I've really tried to be as balanced as I can be on this Trump thing, but there's some days it is so out of control, and the misrepresentations and lies are so extreme, and the danger is so extreme, you sort of feel like you have to go there. So I guess it's a tough question for me. 877-301-8970. You always defend the mainstream media. You're going to do it again?
Well, I think it's... I always differentiate the mainstream media from the newspapers.
Well, CNN is mainstream media.
Well,
isn't it?
It is, but that's, you're talking about cable screaming matches at night mostly. You know, it's different than the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, which is doing the bulk of the great reporting, and they have done great reporting.
You think Maggie Haberman should be tweeting nonstop?
No,
one of the great reporters of the New York Times.
I have a real problem, and I'm surprised that they allow her to do that. I mean, she's not that bad. I mean, she doesn't.
They
go,
have reined her in a little bit too.
They have reined her in, but I don't think that's a good idea for reporters to be tweeting anything more than publicizing their story.
I agree with that.
You know, I wrote this story, blah, 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 blah. But so I think the reporting in newspapers has been phenomenal. But I do think this is a different kind of president.
That's what I was trying to say before.
I mean, it's not like, you know, it's everything. I mean, as you said, starting in your show last night, as we said here yesterday, everything is being investigated.
Everything.
Whether they stole money at the inaugural.
His charity. His foundation.
I mean,
his inaugural. His transition.
$25 million because he had a fraudulent university where he was shafting people that came here. So this is a guy that was kind of a crook before he came into office and looks like he may wind up being a crook during his time in office or during the campaign. So it's very different. And also that there's you know, as Mick Mulvaney, his new chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney called him a terrible person. So I think no matter what you thought of George Bush the first, George Bush the second, what you thought of Clinton, what you thought of anybody, you know, you didn't think that they were terrible people. You just disagree with their politics. So this is a whole new
frontier.
Yeah,
but the fact that somebody's a terrible person does not change how you should cover them as journalists. I just have to say it is rare that I'm on both sides of the fence here, but I am. I think there are different rules that apply to us without us going way overboard. I don't just mean you and me, but I do mean you and me. But the flip side is I am made uncomfortable. I mean, I watch CNN from the moment I hit my couch until the moment I go to bed.
Well, you can switch to Fox. And what's always interesting on Fox, I often do this just to see how they're playing something. If it's a very bad day for the president, what they'll often do is they'll do something like Laura Ingraham a week or so ago did some sorority sisters fight about taking down Confederate statues down at some southern school. They'll do something about protests. Should people be able to – conservatives be able to speak at liberal colleges? They'll do something that has absolutely nothing to do with the news. I think Fox News is done a real disservice to the country because it's all about fear. It's all about getting people afraid of things.
Well, they also ignore the most important
stories.
That's
what I'm saying. They ignore them. During the day, they do very well, but at night, and I think that's what most people watch is the nighttime stuff.
Well, you know what? But even they, by the way, you know who their chief legal analyst is?
Fox?
Judge Napolitano.
Judge
Judge Napolitano said? I think it was the Shep Smith yesterday.
Well, he criticized
that Trump
the president.
Is an unindicted co-conspirator.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially saying what I said in the open here, were it not for the presidency potentially shielding him from indictment, that he would be indicted. By the way, speaking of fraud, one of our colleagues just posted for us, the Washington Post is reporting, Trump has agreed to shut down his embattled personal charity and give away its remaining funds amid allegations he used it for his personal and political benefit, the New York Attorney General announced on Tuesday. So I guess our question is, off the president's fairly regular criticism of usually NBC and CNN, is he on to something, or are these such unusual times with such an unusual president that maybe the press is doing just what it needs to do?
And I think the other thing is about the president is that he used to deal mostly with the gossip pages. You know, he was, as we all
That's
know,
right.
calling up page six of the New York Post.
John Miller, was it? When he he was his PR person?
Or he'd be his son's name. Yeah. Remember, it was, what's the son's name? Bannon.
Don.
What's the kid's name?
Baron. Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that
he'd
one.
Call
okay.
up, he'd be John Barron, or he'd be Baron Miller, or John Miller, or something like that. It would be Donald Trump pushing some of it. So the coverage you get from society reporters and gossip reporters and who's going to what kind of party reporters is much different than the people that you get that spend 7 hours in the basement of a courthouse going through your
Yeah, but
your,
what's that got to do with how the reporters
because
are covering?
I think he had no idea about the media that
he
was going against when
that.
It comes to, again, these top investigative reporters, again, at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And the Wall Street Journal, by the way, is a conservative newspaper. It is a Republican newspaper. And it, too, has been very critical of the president on his news pages.
It has. Let's get some calls, 877-301-8970. Francis from Fall River, hometown of Marjorie Egan. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Francis, what's up?
Hey, good morning. Hey, Thank you for taking my call. First
sure.
off, I watch like MSNBC Morning Joe in the morning, and then I get in my car and I drive, commute to work, and I listen to NPR.
Oh, good. Very good,
boy,
Francis.
NPR news is about as down the middle and objective. It almost gives Trump a false equivalence.
I agree with that, by the way. I think they really strain. I'm so glad you mentioned that. If I had to pick one news source that really does go out of its way to be fair and balanced, NPR is really right up there. And by the way, probably does as well having guests from the full political spectrum as virtually anybody there, Francis.
Anybody could call that liberal. I don't, you know, Mara Liasson, a liberal, wasn't... She was a Fox woman, right, for a long time.
I don't know. I wasn't calling them liberal. I'm saying that they have really worked their way to be fair. And I think CNN, with a couple of notable exceptions, and thanks for the call, has decided that it's got to have a little more edge. And I guess edge means taking a position on the part of its anchors to do better in the ratings. I mean, if you see, I don't know if you read the most recent ratings. Number one, interestingly, is Rachel Maddow.
Yeah.
And then it's virtually every Fox program, and then a few MSNBC programs, and then Cuomo and Anderson Cooper are pretty much tied but near the bottom. CNN doesn't do terribly well, and I assume it was a calculation made by them that they have to shed their traditional impartiality to do better in the ratings.
Well, you know, there was a lot of false equivalency given to Trump during the election,
too. I agree with that.
Some people were pointing that out with some regularity.
Some people criticizing me is what you were trying to say politely. You don't need to. And by the way, I'd say I don't think I was as guilty as charged. I think on some days I probably was a little bit guilty.
Let's go to...
Because in my own defense, no one ever encountered anybody like this guy. And by the way, is
and again, the election was very different because the Democrats, as everyone has said a million times, did overlook this terrible angst in the middle of the country, and people were worried about how they hadn't recovered from the recession, and that you know, the factories were all moving out and all this kind of thing. There was not enough of a recognition of that. So there was some feeling, okay, we're gonna, you know, everything's a mess in Washington, we'll give this new guy a try. What the hell? He's a billionaire, he's built all these businesses, maybe he'll do something. And again, look what he talked about. He talked about an infrastructure plan that was going to employ all the middle class.
Tax breaks for the middle class, universal health care.
We're all going to get better health care. So he talked about all these populist kinds of things. And then he, you know, is governed as a total and complete oligarch. I mean, he's reveling over the fact that they're taking away Obamacare, apparently not realizing that that means to lots of people their pre-existing conditions are not going to be covered, or their kids that are under 26 years old are not going to be covered, or your maternity care is not going to be covered. It's like he doesn't even know sometimes what he's talking about. Frankly, I think he doesn't know what he's talking about.
I frankly agree
with
that.
And that is sort of a problem if you're the president.
By the way, the reason I was not laughing at you with your little rant there. I was laughing because you reminded me when you mentioned factories of what either you or Bob Thompson said yesterday in the great Bruce Springsteen special on Netflix, where he mentions how many songs he's written about factory workers, and of course he's never been inside a factory.
Yeah,
and it's all... like.
But he said, that's how good I am. I imagine it all in my head.
By the way, the New York Times is reporting that the White House says Trump might back down on his demand for the border wall to avoid the Friday shutdown. And by the way, for whatever it's worth in terms of the border wall, I know this is obvious. We'll discuss this with John King when he joins us at 1:20. With Democrats taking over the House, this is Trump's last shot at a serious chunk of money on the border wall. If he fades here, which I think for the good of the country, he hopefully will do.
But that's another thing.
It's over.
That's another thing. All the people that know about border walls point out that a big wall that he keeps talking about is really not going to work, that there are whole sections you can't do a wall there. You need to have more for border security. You need to have more people in the air, more agents, all this kind of stuff. And he keeps insisting on this border wall. It's like it's some... you know, a golden rainbow.
Well, that's one of his bottomless Pinocchios. 86 times he has misrepresented. He's lied or misrepresented, according to the Washington Post.
I mean, we're already building it. He said over and over again, we're already building it. We're already building it. It's looking great. We're doing a great job. Here's the wall.
And how much money they've got
in the past. And they said, Pence, you know, Pence is down at the border. They said, no, that was just to repair the wall that was already there. Pence is saying, no, it isn't.
By the way, you know,
a
perfect example, I'm so glad you said this, and then we'll get back to the calls. A perfect example of what I was talking about before, where it is very hard not to cross what used to be the lines for responsible journalists, is when Donald Trump came up with that cockamamie crap the other day about, oh, Mexico is paying for the wall because of the savings from NAFTA. It was so preposterous that you say, you say what is obvious. Stephen Thornton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call. Hi.
Hi, Merry Christmas.
And to you, of course.
To you too, Steve.
Yeah. My opinion is this. CNN, Fox, we all know what they are. They cater to their groups. That doesn't bother me. That's the games they play. I get it. What bothers me is there doesn't seem to be actual reporting anymore. You watch those pool reporters in the White House press conferences, and they're there writing their notes and asking their questions, and then they go right on their respective shows and offer opinions. They're no longer reporters. Reporting is a dead art now.
Steve, are you sitting down?
They're all opinion writers.
Steve, are you sitting down after years of us talking to you on the phone? You and I are about to agree. I don't think they should be on these talk shows. If you're a columnist like Marjorie is in The Globe, or you're an editorial writer, that's totally fine. If you're a straight reporter doing straight facts, news for people, you should not be opining, to use a word I can't stand, on these talk shows. I think you're right.
But again, Steve, I will defend those are, again, the nighttime talk shows. And those are the people that are not really doing the reporting.
Marjorie, you were wrong.
Excuse me. I would refer you to the reporters who did an in-depth, month-long study of the president's financial dealings in the New York Times, which were absolutely incredible. They did better.
They're the exception. They won't do interviews. The vast majority of New York Times, and Washington Post reporters go right on the nighttime cable shows,
Jim,
and give their opinions.
You are making...
Steve, thanks for the call.
There's a difference between newspapers and the nighttime cable
shows. But if it's the same person, it is reasonable for the Steves of the world to believe that it compromises their reporting.
Maggie Haberman was not doing the... And besides, is not doing the investigative stuff on his finances or his taxes or these other things. I mean, she is covering...
But some of the New York Times reporters that do. The woman is on John King virtually every single day, whose name will occur to me in a minute. A lot of the Washington Post people who do things are on CNN and on other networks. They shouldn't be. And even if they try not to cross the line in their commentary on cable shows, if that's they have the same name as the person writing news stories, well, there's no such thing as a morning paper anymore. In the newspaper, it troubles me.
You have to give me some specifics. I'm not sure who it is.
Maggie Haberman is a perfect example. By the way, you say she's not investigative. If she writes about news, she writes about facts,
I think
she shouldn't be editorializing on CNN.
I think what she does on... I would disagree with you. I think maybe there's time she's editorialized. I've missed it. For the most part, she is giving her opinion on something based on the factual reporting
right,
she has
and
done.
And she shouldn't.
Like, what is the mood in the White House? I suppose that's an opinion. But she
I don't
can
have
say,
a problem with that.
I've talked to 12 people, and this is what they say is going on. I don't think she's saying, this is what I think, as Maggie Haberman. This is what I've learned from my reporting, and I think there's a distinction
okay. I hear
between
you.
The two.
It bothers me. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Rob in the car. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Rob.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I get my news from Saturday Night Live and probably
and where? I didn't hear that. Where else?
And, Trevor Noah, John Oliver.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Then I balance that with NPR.
Excellent.
And I think CNN's gone too far and Saturday Night Live hasn't gone far enough.
Did you see... last week, Saturday Night Live, when they had they did a takeoff on "It's a Wonderful Life," where Trump was like Jimmy Stewart, and it was like he hadn't become the president. Although I did think my favorite skit on Saturday Night Live last week, and I think we can all relate to this.
Yeah.
At least those of us who have Christmas trees. Rob, did you see the part where the poor ornaments that were relegated to the back of the tree were bemoaning their sad fate? They're facing the wall because the people don't want them in the front of their Christmas trees anymore. That was the funniest skit of the evening. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, but on a serious note, John Oliver does a pretty good job.
He's great.
He goes in depth into issues. There's a lot of humor in there, but he does. And some of those guys are pretty good.
Can I give you, John Oliver is one example. I never understood net neutrality. I never understood its impact until right before the FCC voted to abolish it, of course, until John Oliver's brilliant shows on net neutrality. So I'm with you, as long as people realize where they're coming from. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, I think
it.
He sort of has established his bona fides.
I think he has too.
You have to wonder where he's coming from or where Samantha Bee is coming from, either on full frontal. Anyway, we're asking you if the media is failing to be unbiased. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Trump's tweet in response to SNL's latest Trump takedown. He tweeted, "A real scandal is the one-sided coverage, hour by hour, of networks like NBC and Democratic spin machines like SNL. It's all nothing less than unfair news coverage." And we're asking you, is he right? Marjorie thinks not. I think occasionally he is. 877-301-8970. But while we can have a debate on the basis of fact about mainstream media, there's no debate about the Fox News of the world. For example,
or MSNBC.
Are they obsessed, Fox News obsessed with Ocasio-Cortez to the point of sickness, by the way? Even though in this one story, Marjorie and I this morning were trolling around on the internet, and we see this great headline, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez announces, quote, self-care break before congressional session even starts. And we thought we'd bring that with you. Here she is announcing yesterday on Instagram she's taking a week off to upstate New York for a week of self-care.
Hello, everybody. I am starting a week of self-care where I am taking the week off and taking care of me. I don't know how to do that, though. I would appreciate any and all self-care tips because sometimes people are like, top 10 tips for self-care. Go to Cancun. I'm like, is it a face mask? I just don't understand.
It's almost like satire, I have to say. There is an element of that. But 877-301-8970. Well, by the way, Sarah Sanders is saying on Fox, the administration would be willing to compromise over border security and the spending bills pending in Congress. At the end of the day, we don't want to shut down the government, she says. We want to shut down the border. Again, we'll discuss that with John King at 120.
Yeah, I have to contrast Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with your buddy Nancy Pelosi.
What about
her? Who's 78 and stood for 8 hours in her spike heel shoes doing a filibuster on the DACA, the Dreamers.
You know, by the way, you
never took a bathroom break.
You're going to get me in trouble, by the way. Mm-hmm. I am. She has been an incredible Speaker of the House and Minority Leader. I just think it's time for a change. It has nothing to do with the quality of her work as a leader.
Seth Moulton, you had him on your TV show last night.
And he cut a deal.
He cut a deal.
Or agreed to a deal.
And
I don't
she's
going to
be
deal.
Gone in 4 years.
Maximum
right?
of 4 years.
Maximum
yeah.
of 4 years. So she will be gone. I think that by that time, she probably will be ready to retire. She'll be 82 by then.
In any case, let's go to David in Lexington. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Donald Trump's criticism of the media and whether he might be on to something. Hi there.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Yes, he is on to something, and it goes right back to him. That border wall, that's never going to get built, but there's an easy way that he could stanch illegal immigration just by passing a national mandatory E-Verify. It would be far less expensive, and it could be implemented in weeks instead of years.
But David, don't you think he should do a mandatory E-Verify for his own employees before he worries about the rest of the country? Maybe that would be a good start, don't you think?
That's a good point, Jim, but I do think that the wall doesn't catch visa overstayers. And visa overstayers are 40% of illegal immigrants. And
but David, the assumption you were making, if I may, is that he actually cares about the issue. I would argue he doesn't care about the issue at all, except for political reasons. I don't think he cares if it's effective. I think he cares in terms of the wall. He made a campaign promise. He can't go go ahead.
I'll go even further than you, Jim. I don't think he favors catching illegal immigrants, because he's a tool of the Koch brothers. You know, Mike Pence is a tool of the Koch brothers, and when Mike Pence signed on, Trump became a tool of the Koch brothers, and they like the cheap, easily exploitable labor. So Trump doesn't want to do anything to stop illegal immigration, I know that he knows about E-Verify, but he doesn't want to do anything to stop it because there goes this, the cheap, easy.
Now we got it. David, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
John from Rhode Island, thank you for calling.
Hi, John.
Hey, just a point to consider that there's the truth, the light of truth, there's opinion, and they're very different. And I believe everyone's guilty of adding that. It's just human nature. And the danger in that, and whether it be parody or satire or ridicule, whatever it looks like, when we veer off of the truth, in fact, I think it was Pacman, the guy, the radio talk show host, spoke about fact check when either Trump or you and Marjorie or myself, for that matter, is on the line talking about stuff. If there's a fact check right after that to say, oh, what's the percentage or what's the real bottom line of the story? And we've gotten away from that. And there's a danger in that. And I want to say this, and I'll be done in like 30 seconds or less. There's a danger in that because when we start to make fun of or we start to dilute the truth with our opinions, we offer everyone this collective consciousness of, oh, well, you know, one person doesn't matter. And the next thing you know, 100 people don't matter. You get my drift?
I do get your drift, but I have to say, I rarely will say something in praise of us, but I will do it right now. We make corrections when they're brought to our attention by our coworkers or listeners on email, Twitter, immediately. We take that really, really seriously. So at least as relates to Boston Public Radio, I hope, despite what you said, you don't see that problem here. Thank you much for the call, though. We appreciate it. 877-301-897. We forgot. Who created the term? Wasn't it alternative facts? Was that Kellyanne Conway's
yes.
description on the White House lawn one day?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then her husband called her a liar as soon as that was over.
Well, it's
he didn't, by the way. I wanted to make sure Marjorie was paying attention.
But it started really early, you know, because remember when Sean Spicer had to come out and lie about the size of the crowd on the
day one,
first
wasn't
day
it?
Of the
day one,
Trump
yeah.
presidency. Yeah. Amina says she agrees with us about CNN, which she watches all the time. She said she's been surprised and disappointed by some of what she's seen from the hosts. But I also think, and this is your point, Jim, with someone so outrageous who lies constantly, it's hard to not cover that and even more difficult to find a fair way to represent that
I
point
agree
of
that.
View. And
I
it was a long time before people even used the word lie. It was
that was a big debate in the
yeah,
media, actually.
You say the president misrepresented or the fact was misconstrued. I mean, there was a great hesitancy. I think now we're on the lying thing.
Well, because lie speaks to intention, does it not? I mean, it speaks
well, you
to
know,
the intent.
You know what's really the thing about the law? He said over and over again, they catch 10 terrorists a day. That's just not true, and he keeps saying it over and over and over again. And the reason I get upset about Fox is because the nighttime, as opposed to the daytime, repeats a lot of these things, and it gets people very afraid. And
or he repeats what he hears on Fox more frequently, by the way.
Yes.
So that's it for now.
That is it for now. Okay, up next, we're going to talk to Governor Michael Dukakis. He's going to talk with us about transportation, the future of the Democratic Party, and also his remembrances of George H.W. Bush. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Are we allowed to say he's one of our favorite guests, considering I don't think he's running for anything again in the
future? I think we are.
Okay, fine, then we can. We're joined by former governor and Democratic nominee for president and the greatest advocate that the North-South rail link could ever have. That would be Michael Dukakis. Governor Dukakis, of course, is a distinguished professor of political science at Northeastern, visiting professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. Governor, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you all, both of you, for what you do.
Governor, I was thinking about you when we were talking about the media coverage of the president, and I wondered, I don't know what media you even consume, but there's a sense among the president's supporters that the media has been terribly biased against him. They're mostly talking about CNN, MSNBC. Fox has been in favor of most of the president's moves, and newspapers are a different realm. But what do you think of the media coverage of the president? Have you developed any opinions on that?
I think, look, you guys are pros in this business, but I think it's very difficult to cover this president.
It is.
Because the fact of the matter is he's a pathological liar. I mean, that's clear. And I'm not being a wise guy about this.
Yeah.
I don't even know if he knows that he lies. But he lies all the time.
Yeah.
And he's the president of the United States and one of the leaders of what used to be the free world. I'm not quite sure what it is these days. So how do you cover that? I mean, you folks are in this business. You can't ignore it, especially when the president of the United States keeps saying things that are false.
Well, you know what you always hear? You always hear, well, politicians lie all the time, and then if they're talking about Barack Obama, the same lie they repeat all the time is if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. I would call that a misunderstanding, not a lie, or that Bush lied about Iraq. I don't know. I'm hoping that was a mistake and not a lie, but you hear that. Politicians lie all the time. You've been a politician all your life. You think that's true?
Look, I've worked with politicians. I was one. I still am one, I guess, semi-retirement, but not that retired. From time to time, you make mistakes. Or maybe you make a judgment which turns out to be wrong. And if you do, then you shouldn't be surprised if you're criticized for it. This is very different.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy that continues to say things that are simply not true. And again, I don't know whether it's psychological. I mean, there is something beyond just simply lying here with this guy. Does he believe what he's saying? Does he just pick up this stuff on Fox and repeat it, or what? But as a journalist, and you folks are as good as they come,
Governor.
Well, I mean that.
I think he's talking about you, Mark.
Love your column.
Thank you.
It's great. But you can't ignore this, especially since people all over the world are listening to him and think he's serious. And I don't know how you do this, professional journalist, but I think the responsibility of the press, and I don't care whether it's Trump or Dukakis or Bush or the man on the moon, is to cover us aggressively, to make sure we know what we're talking about, and to make sure the best you can that people are well informed about what's going on in the world.
So,
and if you have a president that keeps saying things that are just wrong, I mean, look, this wall thing. Have you guys heard Jimmy Tingle's routine on the wall?
Yes. He's going to be on with me tonight, by the way.
Tell him to repeat it.
I will.
I mean, it's hilarious. You know, what does he say? Well, of course, we have this border, but we also happen to share 800 miles of coastline on both coasts, right? That's two
right.
times 1,800.
That's right.
And there is this new invention out there called a boat. And then, of course, you have the Canadian border. That's 3,000 miles.
That's right.
So he ends up with an estimate of some 31 million border guards that will have to be employed to protect our border, which means we're going to have to bring 31 million immigrants into the country to replace them for what they're currently doing. But, you know, it's funny, and he's
Are you going to be in the lounge on Thursday night?
But it's funny, but it's not so funny. Because it makes the whole project so ridiculous. By the way, there's one other little problem here. We're running, or soon we'll be running, a $1 trillion annual budget deficit.
Yeah.
So all of this money is borrowed. I mean, even the Democrats, well, we're going to give tax breaks and this, that, and the other thing. With what? Now, you know, I'm supposed to be a liberal, but I used to describe myself as a liberal who can count. And I'm very, very concerned about this. I mean, it took Bill Clinton several years before he closed the budget gap and finished up with a very handsome surplus, which, remember, he wanted to use to reduce and eliminate the national debt in 10 to 12 years. So Bush comes in and gets us into this stupid war in Iraq, which, by the way, is now in its fourth trillionth dollar.
Gosh.
And we're still spending money in Iraq. Forget about Afghanistan. And nobody seems to be concerned about this except, you know, me and, you know, three other people. I mean, I'm very concerned about it, and I don't understand what people are talking about. We're spending $750 billion on the military, and all we do is get into trouble. And I think we've got to start having a discussion about that and a national debate about it.
You know, Governor Dukakis, I was actually going to bring up, you were talking about Bush the Younger. I was going to bring up your comments about Bush the Elder a little later, but since you mentioned W., your remarks were very measured after George H.W. Bush died. How much do you carry, though, in you resentment about this Willie Horton thing that while Lee Atwater on his deathbed apologized to you for it, President George H.W. Bush never apologized, just tried to pretend that since it was a PAC or whatever they were called then, he really had nothing to do with it. How much resentment do you harbor, or have you?
Well, I didn't enjoy the Bush campaign, needs to say, and it wasn't just a so-called independent group. I mean, the Bush campaign itself was running that famous revolving door.
After the Horton, remember? That's right, of course.
All of the faces of those acting inmates coming out of jail were either brown or black, if you watched it very carefully.
Yeah.
So it wasn't very subtle. But look, I blame myself. And it's still continuing. I almost picked up the phone and called Beto O'Rourke, who
yes,
I don't know.
I
sent him $100. But I almost called him a month before the campaign was over, and I said, look, pal, you got a great chance to beat this guy. But you're doing the same thing Kerry and I did. I mean, you've got to respond. You've got to turn his attack campaign into a character issue on him, and that would not have been very difficult to do with Cruz. Well, O'Rourke did it, but in the last week,
yeah,
closed about a 7-point gap mm-hmm. to two. Another week and he'd have won the thing. I mean, we just can't keep doing this. So I blame myself. You know, I said I didn't want to get into this and I wasn't going to respond to the Bush attack campaign. But if there's a lesson to be learned from my campaign, it is if the other guy comes at you with his stuff, you've got to have a carefully thought out strategy for dealing with it. Doesn't mean you've got to get down and nasty, but you've got to have a strategy which, to repeat, turns his attack campaign into a character issue on him. I was able to do that my second campaign against Ed King, but I just didn't do it in the presidential campaign, and, you know.
You're a better man than I.
Shame on me.
You know, before we get to North-South Rail, which we know is, and I mean this in a loving way, is your obsession, we talked about how the press is handling this presidency. How are your fellow Democrats handling it? There is, as you know, an overwhelming majority of Democratic voters who want them to proceed on impeachment. I think it's fair to say that many of them are dancing around at the moment, even those who had said he was impeachable a year ago. It's now wait for the Mueller report, despite day after day stories of things that most people, Larry Tribe, thinks are indictable offenses, others think they're impeachable offenses. How should they be playing this impeachment thing, Governor?
I'm not a big impeachment fan. I think we just could go out and beat his brains in politically in 2 years. I mean, Let's beat him. Let's beat him decisively. I think the midterms were a good start. And if they keep it up on this health care thing, he's not going to have a prayer. But
you mean after the court decision in Texas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's the way to end this really crazy kind of period in American politics and get back to something a lot better and a lot more reflective of what the American people really are and what our values are. So I really don't think, Jim, that spending a lot of time in impeachment makes sense. Let's just get out there. Get off this red-blue thing. I don't know how we got into this. This has got to be a 50-state campaign. I'm a great admirer of the former governor of Vermont when he was the Democratic Party chairman.
Remember? We're talking about Howard Dean, of course.
Howard Dean, who
okay.
said this is going to be a 50-state campaign. I remember Rahm Emanuel and some of these folks saying, what is he talking about? We're just interested in 16 congressional seats. Why are we giving money to the Wyoming Democratic Party? And to his credit, he said, I said it was going to be a 50-state campaign. It's going to be a 50-state campaign. It was. We swept the Congress. And if you talk to the Obama people, they'll tell you that the work that he did was enormously important to them as they went out and won the presidency. And who says that Kansas has a fine new Democratic woman governor.
That's true.
And at least one new Democratic congresswoman, is it? With a very interesting background.
I'm not sure.
Texas has got a flock of new members of Congress.
Yep.
And as I say, if Beto had been, I think, more aggressive and not done what I did and Kerry did, he'd be the new United States senator. And I just think we got to get out there and work our tails off in every single one of the states. Hey, I carried West Virginia by 12 percentage points.
Wow.
Why? It's a tough, working-class state that needs and deserves a lot better than what it's been getting, especially when it comes to regional development. I mean, wasn't it Jack Kennedy who said we got to do something about Appalachia? And he did.
Yeah.
And he was hugely popular. What happened to that? So that's, Jim, what I think. I don't. I, I think we're wasting our time on this impeachment stuff.
Can we move to the thing you've been spending a lot of your political capital on, and with your, I guess, colleague, we can call him Governor Weld, North-South
and
Rail.
Former law associate, you know. He and I practiced law together. Yes, indeed.
I didn't know that.
Was that
Helen Bartlett? Where was that?
Helen Bartlett. In fact, I was responsible for the young associates, and one of them was Bill Weld.
Oh, yeah?
So we started.
When he was young and irresponsible?
No, he was young and quite responsible,
okay. So where are we on this? We read Nestor Ramos's great piece about only Michael Dukakis waiting an hour to testify and not being aggravated at a DOT.
Although Bill
thing.
Weld was there, too, and
I
did
know
a
that.
Terrific job. A terrific job.
Where are we on this? Because every time you're here and we talk about this, here's my contention, and you can respond to it again, that Charlie Baker is simply being respectful to his mentor, Bill Weld, and to you as a former governor, but he has absolutely no intention of ever funding this thing. Tell me I'm wrong.
Let me say two things. First, this goes beyond just the North-South Rail Link. This is about whether or not, Jim, we're going to have a first-class regional rail system, not only in Massachusetts but in New England, that connects every one of our so-called gateway cities, not only with Boston, but with the Northeast and the rest of the world. Because remember, this is on the Northeast Corridor. And the only gap between Washington and Portland, and ultimately, I hope, Montreal, is this one-mile break in downtown Boston. I mean, it's a positive embarrassment. And we've got a responsibility to close that gap and, to repeat, build a first-class regional rail system. Why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we doing it? Because, for reasons I don't understand, the governor doesn't seem to understand how important this is. I mean, we're choking to death on traffic, aren't we?
Yes.
I mean, it's terrible.
Terrible.
And it's going to get worse. My colleague and friend Barry Bluestone tells us that in another 4 or 5 years, are you ready for this? Traffic on the Southeast Expressway at 5 o'clock in the afternoon will be moving at 3 miles an hour. I mean, he's not kidding.
No, he talked about it, that report done in your name, by the way, a couple of years ago with us.
So there ought to be a sense of urgency here. Charlie's just been reelected by a very substantial margin. He's got 4 years ahead of him. I don't understand why he isn't deeply into this. And again, it isn't just filling the gap, though that's very important. It's dramatically improving our regional rail system, which doesn't cost a lot of money. We're not talking about huge investments here. I mean, and the other thing is this. Sorry to go off on this.
No, please do.
One of the problems down at the State Department of Transportation is that they have no internal engineering capacity. I had a guy, I think I may have talked to you about him in the past, named Frank Kevel, who was the director of planning construction at the T. Who was Frank Kevel? An Irish kid from Dorchester, Northeastern Civil Engineering co-op student.
Excellent.
Co-opted at the T, went to work at the T. I didn't know him when I first became governor, but Fred Salvucci knew him. And Salvucci, of course, was my transportation secretary. And he created something he called the Transportation Construction Directorate, and he put Kevel in charge. That guy did $3 billion worth of construction for us in the 80s, on time, on budget, including, by the way, Marjorie, the extension of the Red Line from Harvard Square to Alewife, which is basically the North-South Rail Link, although a half a mile longer. In current dollars, $1.7 billion, okay? And I think it's working pretty well. It's totally revived North Cambridge and some of it.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That was one of his projects. There wasn't any fuss about this. I just showed up for the ribbon cuttings and said thank you to people. There is no such capacity.
So what is the problem? Sure, you know, clearly there's some big dig hangover or whatever people call it. There's no question about that. But what is Baker's a very smart man. I believe the Secretary of Transportation. Is she not a former protege of yours, Stephanie
Pollack?
I'm
not sure she's a protege. Whatever. Deputy Director of the Dukakis.
Well, I guess. She's a very smart woman, too. If this is such a critical piece of our infrastructure, why do you, Weld, and Moulton get it, and they don't?
Beats the hell out of me. I don't know. They're so cautious. I mean, look, this is no time for caution. 3 miles an hour on the Southeast Expressway in the next 3 or 4 years. It's time for action. But they've got to equip themselves with top-notch people. They've got to equip themselves. Look, how did we do the Boston Harbor cleanup? On time and 20% below budget while the big dig was flying out of control. Because we had a terrific chief engineer who ran that job. Now, he hired consultants. You know, Some of my best friends are consultants. But you got to have somebody. You got to have somebody in charge. There is nobody in charge. Look at this. Look at South Coast Rail. If ever there was a region of the state that desperately needs. I mean, a good train
would
to South
change everything.
A good train to southeastern Massachusetts would completely revive that part
it,
of the state.
Totally.
And as you know, Marjorie, it's been, you know, constantly kind of behind
yes.
economically. Same with western Massachusetts, right? Okay, so when I started hearing about the numbers that they were quoting at MassDOT, I called up two of the best people I know in transportation construction. And I don't want to embarrass them by telling you who they were, but
you'll
recognize them in a second. Okay, one of them, without hesitation, when I said to him, John, what should South Coast Rail cost? Said, $500 million. Okay, the other guy I called and I said, Joe, couldn't we do South Coast Rail for $1 billion? He said, that would be very generous. You know what the MassDOT estimate is for South Coast Rail? $3 billion. It's crazy.
Well, it's the same thing with the North.
The same thing we got from them.
South and North Station.
Yeah.
It's much higher than you think it is. I figured this was about money that the governor, as in Baker, has been very hesitant to. I mean, he spent a lot of money in the T, but not like a big picture kind of thing. He doesn't want to raise taxes. And I figure he figures he's got to raise taxes for all these railway projects.
But if you check the studies that were done when Bill Weld was governor, and some very good people were part of that advisory committee, what you find out is that the combination, first, of the fact that this is a federal project,
right,
very important, eligible for up to 50% of the cost because it's in the Northeast Corridor. Secondly, there are going to be thousands and thousands of new passengers. Jobs and passengers.
Yeah.
And third, according to that study, there were going to be about $80 million in administrative savings, which the latest consultant says don't exist. Of course they exist. You put it all together, and the project pays for itself. So money should not be a problem.
So should the Democrats take over the House? Does that make you more hopeful about your prospects here?
I think it certainly makes me
more hopeful.
In terms
of federal participation.
Not only that, we've got some. We lost Mike Capuano, which was a great loss in terms of the transportation side of things. But we do have the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and the chairman of the Rules Committee.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And we have a chairman of the House Transportation Committee who was born and brought up, I can't remember if it was Needham or Natick. Peter DeFazio is a native of Boston who now has been representing Oregon for the last
years.
But he's a big fan, knows the area cold, and very much an ally.
Have you spoken to Richie Neal about this? From Springfield, who will be the Ways and Means Chair?
He's for it. He's
for North-South Rail.
He's for North-South Rail as a part of a first-class regional rail system, which, by the way, connects western Massachusetts with Boston. And that's very important, as you know. Eric Lesser, the new state senator out there, is terrific, has been pushing this very hard. And Charlie has been extremely reluctant to go along with it. He vetoed bill to study the thing. Finally, he came around and has now approved it. So we got another consultant who's going to cost $1 million to tell us what? That an existing rail line, which actually carries passengers, not very well, but carries, and was modernized to Worcester. So we're talking about 50 miles. We're going to spend another $1 million to tell us how to do what? How to take an existing rail line and fix it up?
You know what I wonder, Governor? For a long time in this country, this was a no-brainer. You built highways, you built trains, you built airports, and now we don't build anything, and everything is falling apart. What happened? Why did that change?
Changed because we got a couple of presidents who didn't want to do it.
Is that
when
it?
When Barack Obama was elected, one of the first things he said was, we're going to build a first-class, modern, high-speed rail passenger system.
Which would change the country.
It would change the
country. No question.
Absolutely. Can you imagine if you could take a train from New York City like to Philadelphia in an hour or you might be able to do it.
New York to Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, yeah.
Oh, well, it'd be less than an hour, yeah.
The entire Midwest would be connected.
Yes.
And they need rail desperately. The West Coast does. I mean, does California need a high-speed rail system? Are you kidding?
Desperately.
Try to move on those
freeways. Yeah,
no, it would be a huge thing, about $10 billion a year, which is nothing compared to this increase in the defense budget that we've had since Trump. Why aren't we doing this? Well, clearly no leadership in the Congress these days on this subject, and certainly no leadership in the White House.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure we have to wait around for that. We've got a very sympathetic House now. We've got some key Massachusetts members of Congress who are there. We know what we got to do. We should stop fooling around with this South Station expansion thing on which Charlie spent $40 million to tell us what? That it's going to cost us $4.7 billion to expand South Station? If you do the North-South Rail Link, you don't have to expand South Station. You got to get rid of that. You don't have to expand North Station, which, by the way, is going to require expansion. You'll save $2.5 billion at least in getting rid of those projects, and you can get cracking on this one.
See,
what's
the difference?
The delay?
Can I tell you the difference between that hearing you went to in Boston Public Radio? Here, you don't have to wait an hour to make your case, Governor. Governor, we only have a minute left before you go. Who attracts your fancy amongst the potential field for Democrats in 2020?
There are going to be a flock of them. I'm not being evasive. I mean, I'm looking myself.
Who are you looking hard at?
I'm not looking hard at anybody. I do think this, and I think we've got to be careful about this, Jim. The last thing in the world the Democrats need is division. I'm glad we've elected some exciting new young members of Congress, including many, many women around the country, as you know. We should be doing more of that, a lot more of it, coming up to 2020. But we're going to have a primary with lots of candidates, nothing wrong with that. I hope they'll avoid the temptation to go after each other. We don't have to do dealing with the incumbent. And out of it, I think we're going to get a good candidate. I can't tell you who that's going to be, but I think we'll get a good candidate, one who I hope Marjorie is strongly committed to a first-class, modern,
absolutely
high-speed rail system across the country.
Governor,
I
it
love
is
railroads.
Great to see you, as always. We really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for stopping
by. And keep up what you're doing.
Thank you.
Very important. Thank you very much. Governor Michael Dukakis is a distinguished professor of political science at Northeastern University, a visiting professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. Governor, thank you very, very much. Up next, Andrea Campbell, president of the Boston City Council. She joins us to talk about school safety and what could be a missed opportunity. She represents District 4. Andrea Campbell is coming up next on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
At noon on BPR, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, have opportunity zones become zones of contention? The federal program is designed to spark investment in places left behind in the economic recovery, but have Boston city officials tapped the wrong places to invest? Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell joins us for that and more. 2 weeks ago, Tom Brady said he was confident the Pats would bounce back from the loss to the Dolphins. 4 days ago, he said his strict health regimen was benefiting him late in the season. 2 days ago, the Pats suffered a colossal loss. Is their reign over? Sports Authority Trini Kuznarek joins us on that and more.
From there, we ask our food writer, Corby Kummer, if the lowly fruitcake deserves a second chance. Then CNN's John King is here. We'll ask him if we should be worried about whippersnapper congressional newcomer Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez already needing a timeout. All that is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Houston Friday, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It is Tuesday. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
What kind of advocate is Mike Dukakis, by the way? I mean,
he's
great. Unbelievable.
He's relentless.
He really is.
He's relentless.
Well,
high-speed rail would change everything.
I mean,
I agree. It's a big deal.
And by the way, if you look at other countries, the Chinas of the world and others, they are passing us by on fronts like that. It is pathetic. You know what I never understood about this either, which we didn't get into with him? The irony is, this is one of these things. You mentioned about in the past infrastructure mattered so much. Do you know who benefits most from high-speed rail? The same businesses that support conservative politicians who aren't willing to spend the money across the country.
Well, we just got an email from someone that's upset we didn't mention the climate change connection. I mean, you get all these thousands of cars off the highways, you'll have fewer gases coming out of all the exhaust pipes of all these cars. But anyway, we're here to talk to Andrea Cabral.
It's not Cabral, Campbell. And it's not Andrea, but in any case.
Wrong guess.
Is the federal government's Opportunity Zones, I'll rescue Marjorie now, tax break program a missed opportunity for Boston? The program is aimed at spurring development in low-income areas, but did city officials overlook the areas that need this the most? Joining us for a take on this, street safety, public schools, and more, is Andrea Campbell. She is the president of the Boston City Council. She also represents District 4. Andrea Campbell, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being here. Whoops.
Hear me?
Is she on the
wrong?
No, we can now.
No, we can now.
Great. Good to see
now.
You.
Thank you for having me. And I love Andrea Cabral.
You do?
I love it.
<You're>
not
I do.
That
Andrea
is
Cabral.
Really so kind
yeah.
of you,
no,
by the way.
She's
no.
been a supporter since day one. We go way back. She's
because great. You know why? Because Marjorie's going to say to me at 2 o'clock, do you believe that I said, right? Aren't you going to say that at 2 o'clock?
I was going to say it now, but I won't say it now because she already said it for me.
But Opportunity Zones.
Yep.
Yeah,
we'll get there in a
opportunity
second.
Opportunity zones are, I'm very confused about opportunity zones. You can straighten us out on that in a second. But first I want to say, I'm really stunned. Your colleague, Ayanna Pressley, is going off to Congress, and Shalene Title have both talked about this, and you've talked about this too, that...
You should say who Shalene Title is.
Shalene Title is on the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission.
Yeah.
She's one of the commissioners. That... There's been a lot of provisional licenses granted, 76, according to this Shalene Title. Not one has been a minority-owned business. And there was so much talk when we were talking about legalization about how the people that have been screwed, basically, by racist law enforcement on drug stuff should be the beneficiaries, and that's not
or
happening.
Or the people who are still in jail for marijuana offenses, right, who aren't getting out.
Yeah.
The law didn't address retroactively releasing these folks, right? So how can you address sort of these inequities in the system and on the fact that many of these folks who were incarcerated or were arrested at some point and criminalized for marijuana use or selling were people of color? So there's more to that than is packed into that article. I think we recently had a hearing at the city council level to look at equity in licensing and to make sure that folks who live in communities in the city of Boston, particularly communities of color, have access to this booming industry, right, this billion-dollar industry. I will tell you, there are a lot of folks who are sitting with licenses now who are people of color, and some of them are in my district.
Oops.
And the question is the city of Boston prepared, ready, and able to get these businesses off the ground here?
What's the answer?
I think there's more work to be done. I think to give Alexis, who was running the new emerging industries credit, she's been doing a lot of work. There's a lot of gray area. They had to figure out the regulations. So she's been doing much of that work. I think we need to resource her and her office more fully. Barros, John Barros, who obviously is the economic chief for the city of Boston, talked about, do we have the ecosystem that we need to make sure that folks are getting the technical assistance they need to get these businesses off the ground? And that doesn't exist yet. My frustration is what's taking so long, and that we shouldn't just be looking to the city of Boston's budget to create that ecosystem. You know, that process is down the line. We should have talked about it in the last budget cycle. We didn't. So we have a lot of catching up to do, and so we have to make sure that we're moving a little bit faster.
A couple of Fridays ago, the mayor was here, Mayor Walsh, and I asked him if he was being an obstructionist, and he said he wasn't. Is he?
I don't think he's being an obstructionist. I think he's, you know, put on the record that he wasn't in favor of it, but it is the law.
People spoke overwhelmingly in Boston.
Exactly. I think it's just, you know, you have to plan. And so we knew that this law was going to probably pass based on polling. It did, overwhelmingly in the city of Boston. We knew that folks would be interested in developing these businesses. And so what were we doing in the meantime to create the ecosystem that was necessary to get these businesses off the ground, particularly for women and people of color? And so I think we're behind the ball a little bit. And so I've been, you know, like I did in that hearing, pushing back to say, how do we work together to get this done? And so we have a lot more work to do.
So let me just be clear about something. It seemed to me that what Barros, the economic person for the mayor, John Barros, proposed in front of the city council, modeled on a Somerville situation, on its face seemed good, that we do one and one, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. We do one sort of investor-owned kind of, I may be using the wrong technology, recreational marijuana thing, and then we do one that fits more into the equity empowerment thing here. One, I assume you think that's a good idea, but your concern is it's one thing to have the formula. It's another thing to have the infrastructure for that latter group to be able to even make applications. Is that where you're going?
Exactly. Whether okay. we do one and one, or we say we're all of our businesses are going to be through the equitable opportunity option, right, which opens it up for more women and people of color. We don't have the infrastructure set up yet. We still have folks who have been complaining about not being able to reach someone at the city to get responses to their questions related to this industry. And I had a follow-up conversation with Alexis to say, how do we work together? How do we meet more regularly to make sure that folks are getting their answers, their questions answered by the city with respect to their application process? And how do we also create this ecosystem? And what needs to be in the ecosystem? Technical assistance from the city. Capital. Where can folks get capital? There are folks in the city of Boston or greater Boston area that would be able to fill these gaps and voids. We have the ability as a city, as a government, to leverage these relationships. Most of these folks do not. And so I want
to. How do you leverage capital? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but where does the money come from?
We are a rich city, and we're in. And if you look at the greater Boston area, we're rich in a lot of ways. So what does it mean for us as a city, the mayor or me or anyone else, to go to certain businesses, to go to certain investors and say, why don't you invest in this young person who lives, say, in my district, the lay person who has a really good handle in this business, is extremely knowledgeable, has the expertise, but lacks the capital, lacks the training. How do we leverage our relationships with these entities to give these folks these opportunities?
Well, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here. I think part of the problem in terms of the slowness on every front, we mentioned this to Dan Adams the other day, the weed guy for the Globe, to Shailene Teitel when she was on TV with me, is the one of the, I don't want to, backup businesses, for lack of a better expression, which is virtually non-capital intensive delivery services, was backburnered by the Cannabis Control Commission. You're shaking your head in agreement. And so while you're building the infrastructure for people of color, lower income people in these whatever zones, empowerment, equity thing we're talking about, that's something that should be moved from the back burner to the front burner so that we can get this equity thing going now rather than later, no?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that came up in our hearing is it's not just about creating shops. There are numerous ways to access this system in this industry, numerous places to create a business and, of course, create jobs. And the spectrum is quite long, delivery, manufacturing, retail shop. So we often just talk about the retail shop. But that being said, one positive development that came out of that hearing is I have a long list of Dorchester Civic Associations and Main Street folks and residents who have come together, and they sent a letter to Alexis and the chair of the Cannabis Commission, Steve
Poplin.
Steve is coming out to the community to meet with these folks. Alexis or someone from her shop will join this conversation, and hopefully this will get the ball rolling faster.
We're talking to Andrea Campbell, who's president of Boston City Council.
Just one last thing about this. I think the first one licensed in Boston is Ascend. That's the first one, right?
Well, they're not formally licensed. They've passed step one, Andrea Cabral has told us.
Yeah, speaking of Andrea Cabral, that's the one that she's the CEO of. But that's there's good money behind that. But that's what you worry about, is that there'll be three or four or five of these before the first kind of mom and pop one, for lack of a better explanation,
you know, my
gets
district,
off the
predominantly
ground,
district of
and
color,
then you're left.
My district, predominantly district of color, you know, women who want opportunities. This is an industry to create small business. I want to make sure that the lay person has an opportunity to access this booming industry, and we have to do a little bit more to make sure that that happens.
We're talking to Andrea Campbell. So, Andrea, I'm sure you listen to the show every day amongst your other responsibilities. And if you do, you know, of course, that other than fighting over teachers' unions, the thing that gets us into our tensest discussions is who should be elected and who should not. We're not going to discuss today the one that puts Marjorie right over the edge, because I actually think judges should be elected. But I surely think that school committee members should be elected. They used to be a quarter century ago in Boston. There's a change. They're now appointed by the mayor. There is at least some discussion about whether or not a return to elected or a hybrid or something should happen. Where is that discussion and where are you?
I haven't taken a position. We had one hearing, which I don't schedule these hearings, and so I couldn't actually attend that particular one. I will tell you, it's not at the top of my list for discussion. And part of it is because there's a whole long list of other educational issues that I think we should be focusing on.
That's exactly what Marjorie said this morning to me.
Diversity in our exam schools, or lack thereof. You know, I'm a Latin school grad. We have to do better. Diversity with our teachers. Access to a quality education. I live in Mattapan. I have a 15-month-old. We think about this every day. I represent Mattapan and Dorchester. We're lacking with access to quality schools. High schools, open enrollment high schools, some of which are referred to as dropout factories. So the list is long on issues we have to address. And frankly, this wasn't at the top of the list when it came to constituents in my district. There are folks who want to have this conversation because they think the mayor overstepped in appointing the interim superintendent. And I think, didn't actually respect the authority of the school committee. That's legitimate. That's a legitimate concern. But there are other ways to talk about how do we make sure that those who are appointed, for example, are held more accountable. And it could be elected. It could be those appointments go through the city council, not just the mayor. It could be hybrid. The list is long. But we need to have a longer-term conversation because we know there's a history here. And there's an assumption that if you make it an elected school committee, all of a sudden what? You're going to get more diverse candidates. You're going to get folks who get this. And what?
The city council this most recent term,
but
didn't we?
Yeah, but it's apples and oranges to a certain extent. And so we just have to be careful that what is the problem we're attempting to address and what are the range of solutions before just going to one.
But since you said what you said about priorities, let me just take one more crack at this for a moment. If you were to stop 100 of your constituents on the street who have school-age children, mm-hmm. how many do you think could name even two members of the school committee? I mean, one of the beauties of elections,
the school committee, or even the council.
But I would argue that when people campaign for, first of all, I believe in democracy, small d, in all forms. We don't have to have this fight today, Marjorie. But the beauty of elections, and imperfect as they may be, is it raises the profile of the players. So you hear names, you learn things about people. I would bet if we stop 50 people in the street, nobody knows.
Know who Bill Galvin is, the Secretary of State. I really don't buy your whole thesis.
What, that appointed people are lower profile people?
Well, they might be lower profile, but I don't think it matters.
Well, I'm going to push back on this, the lower profile. I mean, the school committee has such incredible responsibility. That people do pay attention to the school committee. And they might be able to name more school committee members than they can counselors.
Could you name them all?
Probably yes.
That was a slow
probably
answer, my friend.
Not me.
Don't worry,
no
I'm not going to ask.
Yes. Yeah. So, but I will tell you, I think we have to be careful because there's a history here. And I have folks who have said, let's go to elected. And I have many folks who have said, I was here during that dark past in the city of Boston, so let's proceed cautiously. And in the meantime, though, there's a long list of other educational issues that need to be at the forefront. And that is one of them, but not at the forefront.
Talking to Andrea Campbell. She's the president of the Boston City Council. What do you think of this? What's the mayor's plan? The Boston 2020 or 20? The school building plan that he's put forward. I mean, that's controversial because not all neighborhoods are going to do that well. Build BPS. Thank you. What do you think of that?
I mean, it took 4 years. There was a lot of different conversations to roll this out. And I think when you take that long, people are confused. And so you have a lot of folks who are just confused. It could have maybe been more transparent. We have now schools that are slated to close. Many of my residents go to West Roxbury Academy in Urban Science and the McCormick. And so the question I have is, if you're going to close these schools, where are these students going to go? And they deserve to go to a school that is better than the one you're closing, that has more resources and opportunities for them, maybe a higher level. And in addition, how are we resourcing the schools that are receiving these new students? One of which is the Burke, which is in my district, that has been doing some incredible work. But now you're asking them to receive a new community. That's extremely difficult work. And are we giving them the resources, the human capital, and whatever else they say they need? And so there's much work to be done in making sure that this is a little bit more transparent. And we have to just do better.
We're talking to Andrea Campbell. After a city council, after a recent shooting of this 19-year-old Man, you called for more voices at the table to deal with violence in the city. What does that mean? What voices are not part of
many
that
voices.
Discussion? Like who?
So, you know, I held this community meeting in partnership with Tina Cherry from the Peace Institute, and we said we were just going to listen. We did it in Codman Square, and tragically, as we're holding the public safety meeting, there's a shooting outside the door of a 19-year-old who ultimately passes away. And let me tell you, we're still processing that as a team, as a community. But one of the things that came out of that conversation is, you know, I said to my constituents, I'm here to listen because I alone cannot solve the issues of violence in District 4 or the city of Boston. So the question is not, what am I doing? What are we doing? And you can't tell me as a community, if we actually open up this space to define community to include everybody, including those who are formerly incarcerated, formerly gang involved, maybe even currently gang involved, maybe people we label as perpetrators, if we don't open up the space to include everybody, it's going to be really challenging to do this work. So we need to redefine who community is and what we each can bring to the work. And I'd like to think that with the resources we have in my district, in the city of Boston, the greater Boston area, that this community can solve any issue that plagues the city of Boston. And I say if you get it right in my district, which is maybe the underbelly in certain respects to the city of Boston, we solve all the issues of the city of Boston. And
you know,
the city of Boston is the leader for every urban city in the country.
You just mentioned one of our favorite people, Tina Cherry from Louis D. Brown Peace Institute.
Great.
And talk about including a broader array of people in this decision-making. One of the most moving things I've ever seen in my life was at one of her Mother's Day marches 2 years ago, where she introduced the young man who killed her son, Louis Brown. He was on his way to a peace meeting Christmas Eve,
right,
or some such thing. And I had the two of them on the show together. And you know, the ability, I don't know, I don't want to put words, I don't know if there's forgiveness or whatever there is, but the ability to do what I would consider to be almost impossible things in pursuit of a greater goal, which is that there be fewer Louis D. Browns in mm-hmm. the future, is really otherworldly to me. But is this pipe dream stuff? I mean, other than those moments.
No.
I mean, aren't the Boston police, I mean, one of the things, Commissioner Evans, we haven't had Commissioner Gross on yet. I think he's on, January 18th. I'm not sure, but sometime in January. They've done a lot of outreach mm-hmm. to gang members. I mean, is that not what you're talking about?
No.
What are you talking about?
Just like I, as a counselor, can't do it alone, the police cannot do it alone. And we also have to be mindful of the role that police are charged with in our community. And it's not to, what I like to say, do peace circles or open up spaces for forgiveness in these conversations that other organizations do quite well. ROCA is an example of folks that do these healing circles that are powerful. Police can't do that, and they definitely can't do it while actually trying to solve crime. The powerful thing about the meeting that we created in partnership with the Peace Institute, we had folks from BPD there, EMS, the trauma team, the health commission, folks from a lot of the community-based organizations, those who were formerly gang involved that still talk to people who are inside the gangs and want to get out. So this was an opportunity for us to say, how do we as a collective do this without putting the onus just on the police, just on EMS, just on trauma support teams, or just on a counselor? We as a collective can do it. And let me tell you, there are models, and the Peace Institute is one model that we can adopt.
You know, Andrea Campbell, the president of the Boston City Council, I just learned about these opportunity zones a little while ago, and I read a piece in the Dorchester Reporter talking about your being upset that there were none in Mattapan.
District 4,
this is a way to build up businesses and small businesses, et cetera. I don't understand why there would be any in cemeteries and Franklin Park.
Yeah, so
which they
could you explain what they are
yeah,
first?
Yeah, so opportunity zones are something that came out of the recent tax legislation out of the federal government. And I think why most people ran away from it or didn't pay attention to it, because it's something that happened under the Trump administration. And people were saying, no, no, no to Trump. But there was a piece in there, and this is the opportunity zones, that was pushed by Senator Scott, the black senator
from South Carolina.
Exactly, who said, how do we get folks, how do we incentivize individuals to invest in communities that have been under-resourced and under-invested for years? And if we can get them to invest, what can we give them in return? This is a conversation, frankly, that we've been having when we talk about bringing in Amazon, a GE, or just a single developer who wants to come into a community and is getting some type of break. why I followed this Opportunity Zone legislation was it was an opportunity not for just sort of outside people to come and invest in a community, for those who live there to say, we've been wanting a park for decades. How do we come together and pool our resources to do that while at the same time getting some tax incentive? We've been wanting a grocery store. We've been wanting more affordable housing, more parks, you name it. It didn't limit what the possibilities were. And so when I look at Mattapan and Dorchester, my biggest neighborhoods, and I look at the vacant city lots and what those spaces could be activated into, or I look at all of the demands that my constituents have, the thing that usually is missing is the money to do it. And this was an opportunity to say, we're going to bring in private dollars as well as city dollars. There's different ways to do it. But the only way it could happen is if you designated census tracts or communities into an opportunity zone. To my shock, my district, pieces were designated, but it was cemeteries or places that didn't offer a place to actually invest. There was only one little census tract, frankly, that already had investors. It was like phase three of a project. So that disappointed me tremendously, because the next time you can even designate this is in 10 years. That's a long time from now. And what also bothered me was community and folks on the ground, including me as a counselor, didn't have input. So a unilateral decision was made, and I get it, concerned about gentrification displacement. But I say those are always concerns. But how dare we take away the opportunity for folks to have a voice with respect to whether or not we should have done this? And as a Princeton alum, I'm connected to a lot of Princetonians who said, I don't want to just give you $1,000 for your campaign so that you can do the work. How can I help you in the work in your community? You say you want to have this. You say you want to do this. You say your constituents need this. It's a resource issue. How do we work together on meeting those needs? And these are not folks who are looking to just make a buck. These are folks who really care or live in this city and say, my community is getting a lot. How do I make sure that other communities aren't left behind? And so this was an opportunity, I think, for us to have had a deeper conversation. But that sort of passed us by.
So there's no fixing it? There's no...
Deadline unless the federal first. Government changes the
Did
legislation.
Did you speak to Mayor Walsh about your concerns?
Yes, I've been speaking to his administration.
And what are they saying?
Well, I think they wanted to proceed cautiously, because it was new legislation. There was a lot of gray area. I understand that. There was concerns about gentrification, and I'll be frank, or rich white people coming into communities of color and investing and not allowing them to sort of get the benefit of that.
But those are not illegitimate concerns.
They're not.
Right? Okay.
They're not. But you listen to those concerns, you grapple with those concerns like we do with anything else. So if you're bringing in an Amazon, if you're bringing in a GE or a developer, you still have those same concerns that we address to still benefit our community. And the thing I think that where they missed it for me was these investors could have come from my district, right? You could have limited it and said, only the folks that can invest in these opportunity zones have to come from my district, right? Or they designated other places to be within the opportunity zones, including other public housing authorities, for example. And I said, I have public housing authorities that have not been invested in 20 or 30 years. Why were they not designated as well? What criteria did you use? That's what I want to hear more of, because you can't tell me that these were your legitimate concerns, which I hear, but at the same time, other areas were designated. So folks in my community are asking why those areas are not mine.
Yeah. Is there a big supermarket in Mattapan?
We have worked to do. There are some, but there are food deserts in many parts of my district. There are green space deserts, right? Housing. We need more affordable housing. And these, let me tell you, you connect an opportunity zone with conversations around development, conversations on the ground from community about what they want to see in their community. And a lot more things could have happened in a short order. Versus now, if you rely on everything from public dollars, it can be really difficult to do those in short order. You pull in an opportunity zone or opportunities for private investors or private investment to come into communities where it normally doesn't. Franklin Field, which is a housing authority, maybe could have looked differently overnight.
Yeah.
And so we're continuing conversations. There might be an opportunity to revive this at the federal level. I think that would be challenging. To maybe change the 10-year framework or time frame to something else. But I'm always looking for opportunities to invest in the plans and the visions of my residents. That's my job, right? And when those opportunities are taken away from me, I think, I just get a little frustrated.
I blame you. I mean, that's a big deal.
Good to see you.
Thank you for having me. And on a happy note, Merry Christmas,
and
happy
to you,
holidays,
of course.
Merry
happy
Christmas,
New
Year.
Merry Christmas.
Have you finished your Christmas shopping?
No, but it will happen. But we will have our council holiday party this week, and it's an opportunity to celebrate all of our incredible team members and staff who serve the council every day. And that's joyous.
Is that really a wild bash? It's a wild bash, Andrea Campbell. Is that true?
Apparently. We'll see.
You may want to put some time aside from your official duties. Tomorrow we will be debating on the air the pros and cons of the fruitcake at Christmas. So if you'd like to call in, I can give you the inside line.
Oh, I don't like fruitcake.
Well, I guess you have called in, haven't
Who
you?
Who does?
Nice to see you.
Who
Thank
does?
Be well.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much, Andrea
I
Campbell
do, actually.
Joins us every month.
Who
She's
does?
President of the Boston City Council representing District 4. Thank you again. Up next, are the Patriots still Super Bowl contenders? Sports Authority Trenny Kuznarek joins us for that and more. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan live from our BPR studio at the Boston Public Library. Can Bill Belichick and Tom Brady break out of the Patriots' death spiral to make it to the Super Bowl? I'm trying to be dramatic, Marjorie.
Death spiral.
Or should sports writers be working on their Patriots? This, you'll understand this here. Obituaries. Joining us for our take on this and other sports headlines is Trenny Kuznarek. Trenny's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. Hello, Trenny Kuznarek.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
You know, I think it's going to be the pattern from now until Tom Brady and Bill Belichick leave the Patriots.
A pattern of
is it all over? Is Tom too old? Is Bill lost his fastball? Is everything falling
you
apart?
You mean, is it a death spiral? Is that your question?
Well, it does seem to be an obsession of those of us in the sports well, I'm not the sports media. You're
in
the sports media. But it is. It's what we do, right?
I mean, to be fair, it's been 18 years of almost pure dominance. There have been a couple of off years, and that's it. So, I fully understand. I mean, just coming from a different perspective of having worked in Pittsburgh for 5 years, right when Ben Roethlisberger started to take over the team from Tommy Maddox, and they became a Super Bowl contending team again, and having been in Green Bay during the reign of Brett Favre, and then having Aaron Rodgers come and take over. You know, franchises that are historically good, when you start to see it slipping away, you're irrational. I mean, the talk this weekend after Green Bay lost in Chicago was, you know, Aaron Rodgers is done. He's finished. He doesn't care. He's dating Danica Patrick. I mean, it's no different.
He is?
Yeah. And I don't really like it. I don't think that's a good match. But that's a discussion for another time.
I guess it is.
I'm not our biggest fan.
Oh, I didn't know. The race car driver?
Yeah, I've had a couple of, like, I know we're going totally off tangent
That's
here.
That's
on a tangent, but, like, I've done a couple of interviews with
and?
Her.
She's not worthy?
She's kind of rude and off-putting and, you
really?
Know, NASCAR is not a sport people really know a ton about in most parts of the country. So if you're asking genuine questions, to me, you should be an ambassador for your sport. You shouldn't turn your nose up at me because I don't know everything about turning left, you know, 500 times in a race. It's just an IndyCar. Like, she's an IndyCar. I did not like the way, I've never liked the way she carries herself. She always looks just, and I hate this because they say, oh, you know, women, I don't want a woman to smile, but just be a polite human being. Like, I just want everyone to be kind to other people when doing your job.
Well, that's why the football team is having a bad season, apparently, right? It's her fault.
Oh, I never blamed Olivia Munn, but I might blame her. She's just a ball of negative energy, in my opinion.
Speaking of negative energy, excuse me. So can we get back to Tom Brady? I have to be honest
is
and say,
too old?
Other than
is
the fact we're both 6'5", we've never had anything in common until this week.
What?
Both he and I, Tom Brady and I, are able to fall down when no one's about to tackle us, which really is a similarity. The guy, by the way, I love Tom Brady.
He's great. He's the greatest of all time, but he is hearing footsteps that aren't there. And
literally,
he clearly feels like, he has to protect his body at all costs. And it appears to me, and some will disagree, that he is now unwilling to take the hits that he used to be willing to take, which in a sense flies in the face of everything he talks about, because there was an article on WEEI.com this week written by Ryan Hannibal, where he sort of transcribes this interview with Brady that he did with Jim Gray. You know, and he's talking about with Jim Gray about how, oh, you know, all this pliability stuff.
He's
never
been healthier in his whole career.
He's never been healthier in his whole career, despite the fact that he's wearing a massive brace on his knee, by the way. And it limited his mobility last week because the brace moved out of place and he had a terrible second half against the Dolphins. And then he talks about how his brain is trained to better absorb hits. So if your brain is trained and your body can absorb hits better than anybody else because Alex Guerrero's, you know, juju or whatever it is and his pliability, then why are you folding and collapsing before anybody's even touching you on a football field?
Yeah, so do you have feelings as strong about Tom Brady's future as you do about Danica Patrick's future?
No. I mean, Tom's always been pleasant, you know. I mean, I feel like he's not, a little bit on. I think age and wear and tear is starting to catch up with him. I think that's just natural and normal, and it's okay, and it's what was bound to happen.
Well, he is,
you know, he's a pleasant individual. I don't have the ill will towards him that I do against Danica
Patrick.
But he does
seem a little delusional about all this stuff. I mean, one has figured out how to fight Father Time. You know, it happens.
But he's built his brand around it, right? Like his whole brand with Alex Guerrero. Yeah. And you know what? Even if he would retire after this season or after next season at 41 or 42, he has played at a level that no other pro football player has ever played at this point.
Yeah.
To me, that's all you need.
Like, he was the MVP at 40 last year,
MVP
and he was great in the Super Bowl.
40 years old. He threw 5 touchdowns in the Super Bowl. It certainly, you know, wasn't his fault that they lost. It was because, well, I mean, you could probably blame Bill Belichick for not playing Malcolm Butler. So to me, the impetus behind his method is intact. Like, look at this is what it's done for me. This is what it's done for my body. But I think that in his mind, because he said he was going to play till 45, he has to try to find a way to play until 45.
That's ridiculous.
Or it's a failure. But I'm with you. I think that's Tom, if you're listening, I think that's ridiculous. I think that what you have accomplished is enough. And it's okay if you start to have a slight decline. And you do. I mean, we've seen athletes have to change the way that they approach the game the older they get. We saw it with Peyton Manning. We've seen it even a little bit, I think, with a Drew Brees and an Aaron Rodgers. They're a little more mindful of what their body can handle. And Tom, that's okay.
We're talking to Trini Kuznarek.
With the nightshades, are you supposed to eat them or avoid them?
I think you're supposed to avoid them because they apparently are something. They're inflammatory.
Is it tomatoes?
But some people, but nutritionists, so I asked my nutritionist about this last year. Yeah. I asked her about it and she was like, no, it's everybody's body handles things differently. Like for some people, you should eat nightshades.
Did
like,
you
that's
say
you're
a nutritionist?
You. I saw a nutritionist last year.
Oh, you
because,
saw one. You
much,
have one on the payroll.
No. Okay, I saw her briefly because right before I turned 40, I had put on like 15 pounds, and I was like, what's going on? And my doctor was like, well, you've always been underweight, now you're normal. And I said, I don't accept that answer. I'm not fitting into my clothes the same way I am anymore. And I feel like a chubster on TV, so I'm gonna go see a nutritionist. Thanks very much for your time, my PCP. We're gonna go fix this.
And did the nutritionist give you good advice?
Yeah, basically it was like, duh, stop eating so much sugar, you dope.
Okay.
Your body can't metabolize it in the same way.
And
then I started running marathons again, and that pretty much cures
everything. Yeah, that'll do it. So. That'll do it. Yeah, all that running. You know, Shira Springer had a great piece about 2018 in the Globe, a breakthrough year for women, for change in women's sports. And she went through a whole bunch.
Like, some things that I had forgotten about.
Can I say what my favorite
is?
Yeah, what
was your favorite,
Jim? Since I'm a non-woman on this thing, which I did not know about, that for the first time ever, there was an all-women broadcasting crew.
You know, I didn't know that either.
On the DC United versus the Revs. Obviously, what's it called? Major League Soccer, or whatever the hell it is.
MLS.
That's pretty exciting. A color person, a sideline reporter, and the play-by-play person. That's unbelievable.
And Lisa Byington, who did the play-by-play for it, is normally a sideline reporter. Mm. So for Fox, which, if I can be totally honest, is usually a little bit behind the times on gender issues. Mm-hmm. They were recently sued by a former female sideline reporter for loss of work and being told to change her appearance and whatnot. For them to put this crew together and have them call this game is pretty extraordinary. And then you also have Hannah Storm and Andrea Kramer, two well-respected NFL writers who were on the Amazon streaming of the NFL mm-hmm. Thursday night games this year. And I didn't know this because I usually just watch them on TV. I don't stream them. But Amazon has a number of different streams that you can choose from Thursday Night Football. You can choose the regular one, which this year was on Fox. You can choose one that's done by British guys.
Really?
So that you can, they have sort of like this different take on it. They have one that's in Spanish. And this year they did what they call the reporter's feed. But it was almost entirely, they didn't have an entirely female crew. But it was a female producer, a female director, a female, and then two female sports broadcasters who didn't, they sort of shared play-by-play and analyst duties. There wasn't, you know, one designation for each. But there are, in the NFL, I believe, there may only be one or two total female directors or producers on any major national games. I have a friend who's an assistant director. But she's not, I think there's one for CBS, a female football director, and I think might be one female producer for NFL games. And that may not even be true. So this was a monumental breakthrough thing, not just in front of the camera, because that's usually what we see and hear about, but also behind the camera.
Okay, so Marjorie, here's a trivia quiz for you.
What? I hate quizzes.
Who went to Friends Select School in Philadelphia?
That would be Jim Browdy.
No, not just Jim Browdy. Oh. And the University of Pennsylvania. Who would that be?
That would be Jim Browdy.
That would be Andrea Kramer, one of the greatest women broadcasters of all.
I did not know
you
that.
You see any similarity between the two of us or no?
No.
Thank you. We're talking to, so what was your favorite in the list?
You're both
Philly kids. She's
from
Philly.
Kids, and you're both very accomplished in the media.
We are?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
What was your favorite on Shear's list?
I mean, my favorite was Des Linden because I'm a runner, and I was there, and I got to interview her afterwards. So there's like a personal connection to that. And
American in how many years was it?
First American in 30 years.
30 years.
First American woman in 30 years to win the Boston Marathon. And, you know, she did it in conditions that were nearly unbearable, that were horrible.
Pouring rain, cold,
not
freezing.
Even just rain, but like sleet and wind and it in your face. And you need to be extraordinarily mentally tough to do that. And it has lifted the sport. You know, I think there's a reason that the standards of the Boston Marathon have been raised once again. And it's because more and more women are not just running, but more and more women are discovering that they're not limited by the assumptions people have about female athletes, that we're faster and more efficient than we think we are.
What was your favorite?
I love the women's basketball numbers going up. I love the fact that there was this huge crowd for these soccer.
For the women's soccer.
Yes, and I also love the funny bra incidents. You know, those are pretty
funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those are pretty funny.
Unfortunate. Funny, but unfortunate. Have a sports bra on and somebody
goes
crazy about it. Like, come to a SoulCycle class. It's just like a bunch of sports bras and nothing else.
But obviously the big story in there, which we shouldn't pass, we've discussed
Larry Nassar.
Larry Nassar, obviously, is the big story of the year and finally some justice on that front.
And it's literally dismantled USA Gymnastics.
So we talk a lot about concussions and the damage that can be done to young players that play particularly football. This is a terrible story about this Helsinki family.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about these two brothers just 18 months apart.
So Ryan Helsinki is the youngest of actually three brothers. The third brother's name, and I should have highlighted it in here because I'm so bad at remembering names that I've now...
Kelly.
Kelly Helsinki is the oldest brother. He's in medical school. Ryan Helsinki is the youngest brother. He just accepted a scholarship to play at the University of South Carolina as a quarterback. But Tyler, the middle brother, was a quarterback at Washington State and took his own life last year. And the family immediately asked for his brain to be looked at because he was a football player. And, of course, they discovered one of the highest rates of CTE in someone his age. His parents have become huge advocates for CTE research, but also for better mental health care and better mental health awareness. And they left it up to their son, Ryan, who at that point was already a high-level high school quarterback. Do you want to continue playing? Knowing what you know and knowing what happened to your brother, if you want to walk away, you can walk away. He instead chose to continue playing at his California high school. But if you read the story, it's really heartbreaking because here's a kid who put yourself in this position at just 17, you know, almost 18 years old. Your brother dies. Your brother, who you're extraordinarily close with.
At 21, by the way.
At 21 years old, dies. And he dies possibly, or at least in part, because of the injuries he sustained playing the sport that you love. And now you're this highly recruited quarterback for this, you know, pretty major California program. And not only are you charged with, you know, leading your team to victory and being this stoic, confident person on the field, the team leader, but you're also trying to process the death of your brother, and you're having some people, as you get deeper, you have to, it's a pretty, not a super long story, but it's, you know, at least probably 6-7 pages printed out. As you get further in, there were people who were really mean about the way that his brother died and using it to taunt him.
Yeah.
And telling, you know, Ryan, are you going to go the same way? And using it against him and against his family, and to have to shoulder all of that, that burden, and still be an advocate and still be a team leader and still be, you know, a good student. It was so much that the family relocated to South Carolina. He left school early. He graduated after the football season, and the family just decided to pack up and move and try to start over somewhere again.
And they were in California.
And they were in California.
Clear across the country. Clear.
The brother left left medical school where he was and is transferring to the medical school at the University of South Carolina, all in a hopes in the, with the hope of starting over again and escaping just the scrutiny of being a family who lost someone to suicide.
Well,
but
you know,
good on
outside.
Them for talking about it, because a lot of families, I mean, there's no way you can't talk about it. This was a public story,
right.
A public figure. But, you know, there are many families who, when their child dies by suicide, will avoid the question or talk around it. And this family's talked very openly about it.
How do you like to be those parents in the stands in South Carolina?
I would be a nervous
when their youngest
case.
Son takes his first
hard
hit to the head, a helmet-to-helmet hit or something like
I
that.
I mean, any hit. It has to be. I'm sure the family wanted to tell him, just quit, just stop, you know. But I think, you know, we all say that now. I can't imagine playing football. Knowing what we know,
I couldn't agree with you more.
I can't imagine anymore allowing, if I had a child, allowing that child to play football. I've said it on the show before. My sister will not allow my nephew to play it.
How old's your nephew?
He's only 3 and a half,
okay.
So he can't play yet. But her husband have talked about it, and he will not be playing football. They don't feel comfortable. They don't think the risk is worth it. And so they've made that decision. But, you know, if you've been playing it since you were a kid, if, you know, Ryan and Tyler and their brother Kelly had been playing it from the time that they were little kids,
well,
it becomes a part of the fabric of your life.
Yes.
It's hard to walk away from.
And that's what this story captures so well, that you say to yourself, quit. But then you read the story and you realize it's much more complicated than that for this family.
Yeah, because it's also was their support system. It was his outlet. It was a place to go where he could escape everything that was happening to him.
And he's really good at it.
And he can get a full scholarship somewhere. But the flip side of that is, you know, how many, so let's say you get 2, 3, 4, 5 more concussions in college, and then you get drafted and you get 5, 6, 10, 12 more concussions in the pros. What happens to you? Is your, you know, neurologically, and I don't know because I'm not a doctor, but are you more predisposed to having depression, anxiety, suicidal ideations, because maybe it runs in your family
well,
as
I'm not,
well?
By the way, I'm not a doctor. I can answer that question. Some of the research that came out of BU in last year said that if you take hits that don't even rise to concussion level, as a kid, as a young kid, not as a college football player, as a star, the likelihood of suffering from depression, cognitive decline, that sort of thing, increases in later years.
And obviously, you know what you also wonder, and I don't know this, but you do, is that because professional football players have gotten so much faster, so much bigger, the equipment is different. I know there's different rules now for quarterbacks. You can't go after them the way you used to. But that has to have something to do with this, because you certainly, you know, back in Y.A. Tittle's day or something. I mean, you wouldn't.
You might want to say who he is in the most famous football photograph ever. He played for the New York Giants.
Right.
There's a famous photograph of him on his knees in the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was black and white with blood running down his temple. I think his helmet was in his hand after he'd taken a particularly hard hit.
Were so much different then. They were almost like these
little
pilot.
Yeah, but can I caution you? Chris Nowinski, either on this show or my television show, from obviously the concussion.
They just didn't report it then?
Sports Legacy Institute. Working on, he says this whole notion about doing a safer helmet is a very dangerous thing.
Because the
reality is there is no such thing.
No, I just wonder if it's the size and the speed and
I think it's partially that, but I also think, to Chris Nowitzki's point, there's a false sense of security
in,
I have this big thing on my head. It's going to protect it. You know, I know a lot of guys who play rugby, and they don't wear those. They wear almost, it looks like a little, like, it almost looks like a swim cap, a padded swim cap on their head. So they don't lead with their head because they don't feel protected with it. So they tackle differently. And so this idea that, like, these bigger helmets or ones that are more high tech are going to save these guys, I don't subscribe to that notion. I also, and Gary Tangway, my colleague, and I have this conversation all the time, and I don't know if this is part of the BU study, but I would like to, I would love to know if it is, and maybe the question has been asked, but I've never seen it published anywhere. Performance-enhancing drugs. How do performance-enhancing drugs or any substances that they've taken? Because many of the instances of players that we heard, you know, who started to have these issues often originate from, you know, 1960s, 1970s players when there was a rise in the use of steroids. And while I think, you know, what we think of as typical steroid use has probably tapered off in the NFL, but it's different now. It's the HGHs. It's these different ways of helping your body heal better, but we don't know what, we don't know the long-term effects of these things. Not just athletes, but I mean, it's used pretty, I think, you know, I don't think it's any secret. There have been big articles about how it's used in Hollywood to keep people an anti-aging device. And I would be curious to know, and the only way you can do it is hope that you have a contained set of subjects that don't use any drugs and maybe some that will admit to or have used it. And then, you know, cross-reference those, because I would be curious how that affects it as well.
Just one more thing about this, because I remember being very surprised when Aaron Hernandez, of course, the former Patriots player who killed himself in prison and was convicted of murder, when they found his brain had, you know, he was 26, I think, had massive amounts of this. And then
amounts, I think, that Ann said she had never seen.
And McKee.
Yes, and then this young man was 21, so, you know, you think, wow, that's even younger, obviously. And you read these stories about these kids having these indications of trouble even in high school. So you...
Well, you know, one of the critical issues, they can't diagnose CTE in a living person. Brain. And their goal is to get there, which, I mean, that doesn't solve the problem. But obviously, the ability to know along the way that you got a problem hopefully would cause some more sober behavior.
Or maybe
athletes.
Some real changes in, okay, how do we, if you can detect it earlier, I don't know, maybe there's ways to reverse it. Are there ways
to stop playing when you know it's no longer a hypothetical but a reality?
Right, you know, but at the very least, if you choose not to, because let's be honest, I think we know the effects of what boxing can do to a person. We saw it with Muhammad Ali, and we've seen it in other cases where you can get knocked out cold and you have, again, a greater chance of Parkinson's and ALS and dementia and depression and anxiety. But for some people, if that's your only way out and that's your only way to make money, you might continue to, or if you just love it, if you love the sport and you want to continue doing it, if you want to make that choice, hey, you make that choice. But right now, I think the issue has always been with the NFL is that there's this idea that what they're telling you is, oh, we're making it safer. It's not becoming safer. That to me is a false sense of security.
So Trenton Kuznarek covered the
States. We're going to end
covered,
on a high note.
Covered. She more than covered.
Okay. I mean,
say.
I was the reporter at the Olympics with this incredible team, the miracle on ice.
That's right.
Is that your line?
No.
That's
please.
A good one.
Well, I couldn't think of that.
There's a great
for
headline.
Curling at the Olympics, we should say, where the U.S. won its gold medal.
Yeah, and I can't tell where this piece is from. Maybe
Sports Illustrated.
Yep.
Well, they've got a great headline where they say, life's still a blur for the men of the U.S. curling team, also known as Team Rejects, who won the most likely Olympic gold medal in curling history. So tell us.
So they were called, and for those who don't know the backstory, they were called the Team Rejects because after the 2010 Olympics, which I also covered curling, which you wouldn't know about in Sochi, because the men's team won a single match one time there with John Schuster.
Same guy leader,
as their skip, which in curling is a captain, is your skip. John Landsteiner, who is his first, was also on that team. They were terrible. They were horrific. And so USA Curling said, enough's enough. We should be better at this. We are the best nation in the world, usually during the Olympics, and we are abject failures at curling. So they instituted a high performance program. So they went around, they tried to find the best curlers, and what they were going to do is try to piece together who they thought played each position, each role the best, and put together these super teams. Well, none of these guys on Team USA made the cut. Not a single one.
That's a great story.
A couple of them chose not to try out, like Tyler George, who was the vice skip, the number three on the team. He was like, he was thinking about giving up curling altogether and just, you know, living his life. I think John Landsteiner also had the same kind of thing. So he didn't try out. He might have made the team, but like Schuster didn't make it. Matt Hamilton didn't make it. And so they put together this team, they call themselves the Team Rejects, and they ended up, they just found a good chemistry and they found a way to win. And it was sort of their motivation as let's show you. You want to put together a high-performance team, we'll show you high-performance. And they improbably won the gold medal. And they shouldn't have won the gold medal at the Olympics. I mean, they started out terribly. I mean, it was basically looking, again, like if Schustering ended up in the Urban Dictionary as someone who does not live up to expectations. You know, here's a guy who's supposed to go there and do great things, and he kept failing and failing and failing. And they lost, I believe, to Norway, if I remember correctly, a match they should have won. I think it was a 5-4 final, if I'm remembering correctly. And they didn't even let me talk to John Schuster, after the match. I think I talked to Tyler George, and they were bummed. And John went, I think he told me he went to the zoo with his kids in Korea. He went to the zoo with his kids, and they hung out, and they just got away from it. And he thought, I have to win at least one more match. I can't let my kids, who both of his kids were there, along with his wife, Sarah, at the Olympics. And he said, I can't let my kids, this be their lasting memory, that their dad's a failure. And then they rattled off 5 straight wins and ended up beating Sweden in the gold medal match to win. But sort of like the miracle on ice in the 1980 Olympics, which I don't remember because I was too young, but I've seen video of. The real match that was the bigger deal was actually the match, the semifinal match in which they beat Canada to advance to the gold medal match, because they never should have beaten Canada twice, and they beat them twice in the Olympics. And I'm glad, because those guys like Danica Patrick were kind of jerks. To bring it full circle.
Next time you're here, we're going to spend the whole time on Danica Patrick, because I am
really like,
you have to look her up.
Just
don't know Danica Patrick?
Well, I don't know very much about
her. She's gorgeous, and you know, she's. She never won anything, but she's famous because she's gorgeous and she drove a car. But
whatever, drove a car.
I mean, she hasn't finished first in the Indianapolis 500.
She ever won a
greatest woman driver ever. In any case, we got to take a break. Goodbye.
Is she the greatest woman driver ever?
Yes, she is.
I did not know that.
She's only on no other women drive.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye.
We're not supposed to go to break yet, but we're going anyway.
Yes, we are.
Well, I was just talking.
Oh, don't go to break. Oh, hi, Trenny. How are you?
Trying to get rid of me,
I thought
me,
they
huh?
said go to break and then don't go
they
to break.
They said don't go to break.
But wait a second. Can we get back? I was going to save this for next time you're here. Part of that story, which I love, you don't know this about me. One of my favorite things the media does, your old newspaper before they cut off your health benefits on that Friday when you left at the Boston Herald, used to do a where are they now kind of thing. The beauty of the Sports Illustrated thing is they talk about where, because these guys are these are normal people.
They do have jobs. They go through the list. My favorite part of the story is like the first paragraph. A part-time sporting goods salesman, an R&D technician,
the
liquor store owner, while the corrosion engineer. And it tells each of their roles. But, yeah, I mean, that is the other thing about curling. This isn't Lindsey Vonn or Michaela Schifrin.
But doesn't that make it even better?
Yes, of course it does. They work, you know. And I will say, I follow all of them on Instagram and Twitter. I think most of them don't really work much now. I think they've gotten enough in endorsements. I know they've signed the rights to their story away to a production company to possibly be made into a movie.
It could be like those Bob Sled guys from wherever they were from.
Yeah.
Where were those guys?
Jamaica, that's right.
Well, it'd be the same thing. You know, people expect the American curlers to do that well, and the Jamaican bobsledders.
They didn't do that well.
This
it was a great movie,
story.
Though.
This is America.
It's a success story. That's right.
Marjorie,
we succeed here. It'd be like the 1980 thing. We all got very excited about that because they were all local guys, most of them were local guys, remember?
And Badger Bob, a Wisconsin guy, was their coach.
I did not know that. Okay.
Badger Bob.
Well, Trenny Kuznarek, thank you very
now
much.
We're done?
See you, Trenny. Now
okay.
we are.
Sure.
Yes. Trenny Kuznarek,
maybe.
Thank you very much.
We'll see.
Trenny Kuznarek is an anchor and a reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. Thank you very much. Trenny, up next, we're getting to the big issues of the day. Can the fruitcake be redeemed? Our food writer, Corby Cameron, joins us to talk about that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marge Regan live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Why restaurants have had to abandon no tipping policies and the future of the fruitcake are both on our list for noted food writer Corby Kummer. Corby, of course, is a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and most importantly, at least to us, he is a BPR contributor. Corby Kummer, nice to see you or talk to you or something. Hi.
Hello there.
Hello to
Hello,
you.
Corby Kummer. So, Corby, we've talked a lot about tipping, getting rid of tipping with you. Apparently lots of places tried to get rid of tipping, and half their wait staff took off and said, see you later, if not more. So what's going on?
So it turns out that as beautiful an idea as getting rid of tips is, customers don't like it, and neither do servers. So Danny Meyer, the wonderful, admirable, idealistic restaurant owner in Manhattan who really launched the movement and spoke beautifully about the gains that the whole front of the house was going to see, the whole back of the house was going to see, all the people in the kitchen were going to get stuff redistributed. It turns out customers don't like seeing 20% higher prices on menus. They're scared off by them. It doesn't matter if you tell them 18 to 20%. You're going to tip it anyway. You'll be paying the same thing. They want choice, and they still want to be fooled that they'll be paying less.
Yeah. I don't understand why this, essentially all of Western Europe, am I not right about this, is on a no-tipping kind of thing, and it's never been able to break in at all in the United States. What's that about?
Well, so the whole service included idea is a European custom. Tipping didn't come into practice in this country until the end of the 19th century. There's thought to be a really racist component to it in that the railroad wouldn't pay Pullman porters full wages. So they said, you're going to make up for it in tips. And that caught on in restaurants. Customers started assuming that they had to leave a tip for the server, and then states mandated minimum wages for tipped workers be incredibly low, to the extent that even today in many states it's $2.15 minimum wage. But servers and owners are willing to, you know, put up with this ridiculous system because they can make so much more if they get tips per hour than other workers.
But you in light of the fact that you travel in the restaurant world in a different way than we do, we just do as consumers, is this when people who are as high profile as, what's his name, Danny Meyer, is that the guy's name?
Danny Meyer.
When people like Danny Meyer say this is the future, and almost as soon as he says it, he's got to retract it and undo what he did, does that mean that we're not even going to hear about this in the United States? Because I love the system, by the way, for the next 10 years or so. Is this the death knell for the tip-included movement?
It's bad news. Grub Street, the New York Magazine website, did a piece about this, and they quoted so many idealists, like a guy named Andrew Tarlow in Brooklyn, whose Marlowe and Sons are like incredibly trendsetting hipster restaurants. He took tipping off, and he's put it back. His servers revolted. And they said, he said, I'm losing too many people. Klaus Meyer, the Martha Stewart of Denmark, who came here, opened restaurants, but he's not just incredibly stylish and a TV personality. He was somebody who cared enormously about social justice and feeds the homeless in Brooklyn and is trying to inspire restaurant owners across the country to do this. He's an idealist. He has put tipping back on his restaurant because business slowed down. So Danny Meyer lost 30 to 40% of his so-called legacy servers who went across the street where they could get 10% more and wait for those high-volume Saturdays, hoping they were going to get assigned that shift.
Yeah.
And he is able still, because he owns Shake Shack, because he's an idealist, because he doesn't want to back down, he can still keep his so-called hospitality-included system in which there aren't tips. It's built into the menu prices.
You know what the problem is with the two of you?
What's that?
You were a waiter for many years. I'm surprised you didn't
like this.
You're
talking to me?
Yeah.
I was a busboy and a waiter.
I mean, it's like I'm very much opposed to paying everybody the same amount of money for somebody who really works their hard and does it really well, and somebody is a scufflaw. And that's the same thing. You're a good waiter, you make a lot of money. You're not a good waiter, you don't make a lot of money. Good old competition. It's like communism versus capitalism.
Well, except, you know what, people like Danny Meyer said, I don't know him, but Corby does, that there's a lot of bias in tipping, too, which is one of the things, including racial bias, by the way, which is one of the things he tried to undo, obviously unsuccessfully.
It's against African-Americans. It's toward women. It's toward cute, sexually attractive women who put up with a lot of guff.
Exactly.
And worse from customers so that they can get those tips and go home and feed their family.
Yeah, but look at Durgan Park. You got a rough-hewn crowd down there at Durgan Park of waiters and waitresses.
When was the last time you were at Durgan Park? Like 40 years ago?
Not 40 years ago. Just a couple 30. Of years ago.
But I don't think so. I do not
Marjorie,
think so.
What? This idealistic, I'm always willing to be told what the problem with me is. So feel free always to begin a sentence that way. But so many restaurants tip pool tips as it is.
That which is a terrible idea, too.
The fond idea that, you know, they're punishing the scofflaw by not giving that person a big tip. It doesn't matter anyway because it's all going to be pooled at the end of the evening.
We're talking to Corby Kummer. Corby, can we squeeze in right here a couple of Christmas topics? Because I'm afraid we're going to lose you when John King shows up at 1:20. Let's start with the one that's nearest and dearest to my heart, the fruitcake. Now, what I promised Marjorie I was going
to... You are serious, Jim?
I am such a fruitcake, a good fruitcake fan. I told Marjorie last year, and she ridiculed me, and it turns out she was right, that my Christmas gifts this year, I learned that if you make a good fruitcake and you soak it in rum or whatever, you have to soak it in netting or some crap for like 4 or 5 months. I was going to make like 50 fruitcakes for Christmas this year. I never quite got around to it. I will next year. But
don't do it, Jim.
Where are you on? Obviously, we can tell based upon your dismissive comment. Where are you on the fruitcake as a holiday staple
in
America?
It's so important that you said a good fruitcake because that implies a universe in which good fruitcakes exist.
Oh, please.
And you have to say what those are. So I first became aware, my eyes were open to the possibilities of fruitcake when I went to a fancy English wedding, mm-hmm. where that is the wedding cake. And what I really liked
Kate
was the white
it was
dry
Kate and Will,
sugary icing.
Wait, say that again.
That's the one I went to, Marjorie.
What was that on?
It's a white, sugary, dry icing called Royal Icing.
Royal Icing.
Which is just sugar and water, and it dries. But why is it that fruitcake became the wedding cake of choice for the royals?
Why?
Because in the days of ancient mail in which you shipped things by boat, you could send beautifully wrapped little tiny squares of fruitcake to all the people who were fancy but not fancy enough to get an invitation to the wedding. So it would last forever. That's always been the appeal of fruitcake. There's no other appeal except if you like rum-soaked fruit or all of the booze that a wonderful German-born guest will come to our Christmas Eve party. He makes Stollen every year, and he told us in September, I've set the fruit to macerating in the liquor. And the English, everybody, for their plum pudding, it's 2, 3, 4 months. Have you done that, Jim?
First of all, I find your comments stunningly uninformed. That's number one, Corby Kummer. First of all, even if you don't like eating a fruitcake, you need a doorstop, you have one right there.
Exactly.
In all seriousness, by the way, I'm not a big candy fruit fan. But a couple of years ago when we did our first show, it was probably 12, 13 years ago, Marjorie and I, on a fruitcake, a caller after caller suggested a company, you'll probably know the name, I think it's in Texas, that makes fruit. Am I not right about this? There's a famous fruitcake company.
We got one. No, it was from Vermont.
I don't know where the hell it was from.
Harry and David?
I don't know. Maybe it was. I don't know what it is.
Some people sent us fruitcakes.
But it was fabulous. Is your position?
It wasn't fabulous. It was edible.
It was fabulous. So your position is there's no good fruitcake. Is that where you're going?
I really like candied fruit. I really like dried fruit. But putting it in a cake and suspending it isn't always the best idea.
Okay. Well, later this week, we're going to do a whole segment on the pros and cons of the fruitcake. And we'll mark you down. We're going to mark you down as undecided. Go ahead. What?
So there's apricot and crystallized ginger cake in a recent Washington Post defense of the fruitcakes that you can make. There's panettone, which isn't really a fruitcake.
That's not
it's
a
yeasty, delightful, buttery bread that lasts forever and is completely wonderful. So there are light. There are light confections that are yeasty and buttery and incredibly light and addictive. They're just not what we think of as fruitcake.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm making a public commitment on the air right now
to Corby Comer,
and Marjorie Egan for next Christmas.
I don't want a fruitcake,
I will make 50 to 100 fruitcakes.
No, not for me.
For my closest friends and colleagues.
Yep.
And you do have to start. I am right. You got to start like 6 months in advance, right?
It's going to take 6 months of collecting and deciding on the recipes, and then the 6 months to start it.
Speaking of recipes, we're talking to Corby Comer.
Okay, so we have this this great piece from the Atlantic about the seven
which he
best
wrote.
Cookbooks of 2018, written, of course, by Corby Comer. That's why it's a great piece in the Atlantic, Corby Comer. And you mentioned, we had her on, we talked to you about this when she was on, Dori Greenspan, and she's one of your seven great cookbooks of the year. Tell us why.
So I've got lots of aspirational cookbooks that you will probably use, but they're idiosyncratic as well as fantastically appealing. But then there's three books I put at the end. In fact, two of them have connections to you and to the station.
That's right.
So Dori Greenspan. Dori Greenspan does fabulous pastries. We're going to have to find out if she has ever committed a fruitcake in her life.
committed
but in Everyday Dori, her new book, it's What Do You Pull Out of the Refrigerator? And as she probably told you, she tested all the recipes from the Stop and Shop near her Connecticut coastline home, because that's the only supermarket she has access to. It takes her half an hour to get to Cumberland Farms and longer to get to the Stop and Shop. So it's very accessible. It's not that they're all easy, but they all work. And it's a comparison I don't make in the piece, and she probably cringes at, but they have that Ina Garten ring of workability. This is just going to work. And, you know, they're really imaginative. They're just good. There's a Flemish beef stew with beer, another one with a beef stew with cranberries, ginger, and star anise. You know, you could put that into your fruitcake, Jim. And then there's stuffed cabbage, which is this season's trend I'm most excited about. Stuffed cabbage.
Well, you know what I also loved about this, and I said this when she came, especially if you're cooking and you're not a very good cook and it takes you a long time to cook things, that would be someone like I am, and you want to be able to have stuff you can eat right now for your family and then freeze it. And she mentions the freezability of things, which I think is a really important thing for people like myself. And you also mentioned Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Tuesday nights.
Absolutely.
Yes, tell us about that. He used to be
Cooks Illustrated. I don't just pick these of my own incredibly good taste, though it is incredibly good. I canvass people who read all of the books all year and say, and don't write roundups, and say, what will you really use? What is the book you're going to keep when you give all the others away? And I heard a lot about Tuesday nights. Chris Kimball being Chris Kimball, who started Cooks Illustrated, now has his new operation, Milk Street. He has published at least one, I think two cookbooks I've got in my stack just this year. But Tuesday nights is named that because they're such easy, accessible weeknight dinners. And they are going to work. And just every page of these, you know, color standard layouts. It's so exciting, even though there's nothing particularly exciting about the layout. Every time you look at it, you think, okay, frittata with leftover pasta, fresh herbs, lots of garlic, a poaching chicken breast and milk with tarragon, more garlic, and anchovy parsley sauce, chili rubbed pork with cucumber melon salad. It's all stuff you wouldn't quite think of. It all sounds really good, and it's not hard to make.
You know, let me tell you my only problem. So I don't know. I haven't seen all these cookbooks. In fact, the only one I had seen is Dori Greenspan, which is great. And I made something from it the night after she was here. I'm pretty sure it was shepherd's pie because I made shepherd's pie 2 weeks ago and it's fabulous. So I assume it was hers. But you know my problem with the cookbook is you're going to make fun of this. I know you are. But you're wrong if you do. A recipe should begin and end on the same either the same page or a facing page.
That's an excellent point.
One of the worst things, I'm serious, because I'm like Marjorie, you can only make one dish, prune chicken.
Ha, ha, ha.
No, but I don't mean that as a criticism. You make, what else do you make?
I make tuna fish.
Okay, fine. Tuna fish out of a can and prune chicken are her two dishes. I don't know if I consider tuna fish a dish. But why don't cookbook authors realize that ease of use requires you being able to see the whole recipe without having to flip the page.
What does it matter? Because everybody is making it off their iPad anyway. But the fact is, even people who get stuff online, which is an enormous number of cookbook recipe collectors, print them out beforehand. So you can ask Rux Martin, Dory Greenspan's and Jacques Pepin's terrific editor. You can ask others. Depending on the explicitness of the recipe, you just can't fit it on one page. But I'm almost sure I don't have Milk Street Tuesday nights in front of me, but I'm pretty sure everything is on one page. And that there's a color picture on the left, and there's the recipe on the right.
Good.
You will be happy, Jim Browdy.
I am happy. Hey, Corby, happy holiday, Merry Christmas, all that stuff. It's great to talk to you as always.
Corby
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Corby Kimer joins us every week. He's a senior editor of The Atlantic. That's where we get this great piece. You can look it up online about the best cookbooks of the year in The Atlantic by Corby Kimer. Corby's a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest headlines coming out of D.C. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ian live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us online to go over the latest political headlines, including, seems like a bombshell from a courtroom, is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, of course, is the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Hello there, John King.
Happy Tuesday. Crazy Tuesday here in the nation's capital.
Well, indeed.
Yeah, we've been watching CNN, as we always do. So the a federal judge delayed the sentencing for Michael Flynn. What happened?
Well, the judge, Emmett Sullivan, gave him a tongue-lashing. He started the hearing by asking Michael Flynn if he wanted to withdraw his plea if he believed he had been mistreated or entrapped by the FBI. And General Flynn said no, that he was prepared to go forward, that he understood that lying to the FBI was a crime. And then the judge started going through saying, you know, you were the president's national security advisor. You told these lies in the White House. He also started talking about things General Flynn's not even charged with, things that we know, you know, two of his lobbying partners have been indicted for some work they did for Turkey, not filing the right paperwork. Flynn could have been indicted for that. The special counsel decided not to. The judge said, do you think your conduct was treasonous? Do you think you sold your country out? And then essentially, Michael Flynn finally took the hint. The judge repeatedly asked, are you prepared for me to go forward with this today, or would you like a delay in the sentencing? They finally delayed it. Michael Flynn's attorneys finally said, we will take the delay, because they realized the judge was not going to accept the special counsel's recommendation, which was no jail time. And the judge was prepared to send Michael Flynn to prison. The judge saying, now we'll reschedule this once he has a better understanding of Flynn's full cooperation with the special counsel. And that isn't a piece we can't answer, because in the Mueller filing documents, they say that Flynn is cooperating, you know, with X, Y, and Z, but most of it's redacted, so we don't know what it's about. And those cases, you know, obviously are still in the pipeline, or it's an investigation that still continues. But the stunning part here is that Flynn thought he was going to close the books on this and be able to move on with his life and most likely get no jail time. And the judge made crystal clear that he did not like what he was hearing and essentially gave Michael Flynn an out. And Michael Flynn, in the end, after saying no several times, decided to take it.
You know, but it's not, I don't know if you use the word rebuke, John King, but it's whatever it is, it's not just, it seems to me, from afar of Michael Flynn, but of Mueller, is it not? I mean, for them to make a calculation that based upon his level and the quality of his cooperation, that he should get no jail time for serious crimes, and then have a judge basically say, I'm not part of this deal, is a pretty heavy statement to a prosecutor, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And to your point, Jim, I think what the judge was saying is you have not convinced me that the fruit he has given you is worthy enough for me to give him a pass. And the judge specifically mentioned Papadopoulos and Vanderswan. Papadopoulos was the campaign aide, the coffee boy, as they like to call him. Vanderswan was an attorney who worked with them, who both got jail time, short jail time, days, 14 days in the case of Papadopoulos, I think five in the case of Vanderswan or something. But his point was, you were the national security advisor to the president of the United States. Why do these low-level guys get jail time, and I'm supposed to give you no jail time? And he kept saying that maybe you can convince me your cooperation makes it worth that, but you haven't yet. And so Michael Flynn took the out.
You know, John King, what I don't understand about this is usually you have a pretty good understanding of the judge you're going before.
Exactly.
And the judge's record and so forth. What happened here?
This judge is known to be outspoken. He's also known to be someone who questions government prosecutorial conduct sometimes, which is why I think the big miscalculation, you might want to call it here, is that Flynn's attorneys filed a sentencing memo in which they said, we're grateful the special counsel wants to give us no jail time. We agree with that. Thank you very much. General Flynn's cooperating. But then they went on to say, Judge, we just want you to know, we think the FBI overstepped here. We think the FBI was at least unethical here. And that's what the judge wanted to ask about. Do you really think that you were abused by the FBI, misled by the FBI, entrapped by the FBI? And after Flynn answered no several times and said he wanted to go forward and he believed he had been treated fairly and he understood it was a lie, by the way, contradicting a whole lot of things the President of the United States has said and that allies of the President of the United States say in their whole witch hunt argument, Michael Flynn essentially said that's not true today. But then the judge turned. At first, he seemed to be opening the door to Michael Flynn. You know, do you want to make a case here that you withdraw your plea that you've been treated unfairly? And Flynn said no. He wanted to do it today. He was satisfied. He wanted to move on. And then it just went off the rails in the sense that normally, you know, yes, a judge does not have to accept the prosecutor's recommendation. But for a judge to delay the whole proceeding because he says he's not convinced that this is the time to go forward is pretty stunning. And if you're Michael Flynn, you wanted to close this chapter. If you're the president, this is a reminder. Number one, General Flynn just contradicted your case, your political argument here. Number two, as we prepare to go into the Christmas season and turn the page on 2018, the Michael Flynn sentencing, along with many other avenues of an expanding, not contracting investigation, will carry over into 2019.
Does this one last thing on this from me, John. Does this not weaken Mueller's hand in future negotiations with cooperating witnesses when he says to John Doe, if it turns out you are good and honest and open with us, you'll get a sentence much closer to what we recommended for Flynn than what the Southern District people recommended for New York for Michael Cohen? They can't. I mean, there was never a guarantee, but it was close to a guarantee. Does this change that equation, or is this just aberrational and sort of a one-and-done thing with Michael Flynn?
It's a great question. If the investigation is still expanding in a way that there are a lot of those potential cooperating witnesses out there, and I don't know the answer to that part. Are there more, you know, is this expanding in a way that there are more people Mueller still trying to get to help? I think certainly if you're Robert Mueller, you hope you'd get assigned to somebody other than Judge Sullivan.
You know, we're talking to John King. I'm sorry.
John King, speaking of investigations and the president, his lawyer, or TV lawyer anyway, Rudy Giuliani, seems to have, I'm oversimplifying a bit, but it seems to me that at first Giuliani was saying that Trump didn't do anything wrong, you know, no affair, no Stormy Daniels, et cetera. Now it's like he's done different things, but nothing is against the law. He wasn't under oath. He didn't lie, all this kind of. What's going on with Rudy Giuliani and the president's strategy, I guess is what I'm asking you.
If you're saying, can I explain the logic of it, then let's just move on. Because I can't. But it's all politics. You're right about the TV lawyer part, and Rudy Giuliani makes you scratch your head. But if you read what Rudy Giuliani is saying, and I guess politically he feels he has to do this, but it is pretty stunning. First, remember, the president knew nothing about the payments to Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels, denied that relationships took place, had no involvement, knew nothing about the payments. Now Rudy Giuliani, a long time ago, said, actually, no, that's a lie. The president was involved. He knew about them. He doesn't think they're illegal, mind you. But he essentially said the president was lying when he said he had nothing to do with those payments. Now he says again the president was lying when candidate Trump said, I had no conversations about any business dealings in Russia. Now Rudy concedes that conversations about building a Trump Tower in Moscow went on very deep into 2016, perhaps even past the June 2016 that Michael Cohen says those conversations were going on. So imagine that. Your lead attorney's job appears to be to go on television to say, oh, the president was lying about that, about the payments, now about Russia business dealings. What's next? Now Rudy Giuliani says no laws were broken. Nobody was shot. Nobody was killed, is the way he likes to put it. Nobody was robbed. But it is pretty stunning that the president's lawyer views his job in the political climate to essentially go out and say, well, yeah, the president lied repeatedly, but so what?
You know, John, there have been a lot of stories on CNN, The Washington Post, New York Times about the frustration, anger, that the president is feeling as the wall, that's not their term, my term is as the walls close in. When you have people like as you know how we feel about Jeffrey Toobin, he's our fave.
Oh, we love
when you
him.
Have people like Judge Napolitano on Fox News, who's their chief legal person, saying that Donald Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator, and people like Larry Tribe in op-eds and on my show the other night, obviously he is a constitutional professor, a law professor, who's taught presidents, including Obama, but obviously he's not a big Trump fan, suggests that despite the 1973 Justice Department memo that sitting presidents are indictable under the Constitution, is Donald Trump not just worried about a potential impeachment, but about a potential Justice Department indictment of himself?
Certainly, we know he's more and more concerned about the possibility of impeachment, even though most senior Democrats have said, everybody slow down that train. Let Robert Mueller, let the Southern District of New York, let's give them 2 more months, 3 more months, 6 more months, whatever they need. Let's not start the impeachment, a political proceeding, if you will, while the legal proceedings are still ripe and ongoing. That's the majority Democratic opinion. That doesn't mean some of the newer members aren't more ambitious and want to move faster, but it looks like the leadership will stop them. To the other point, look, the president is named. It's a fact. He's named as an unindicted co-conspirator in what the Southern District of New York says are felony campaign finance violations. He is named. Now, Robert Mueller is viewed as a conservative by the book kind of guy. So the idea that he would try to indict the president unless the Justice Department has pulled that guidance, people don't expect that to happen. But the question is, what about when the president leaves office? Could he be charged the day he leaves office? And so, then some people say there's a statute of limitations on campaign finance, which runs till, I think, 2022. So my joke has been, re-elect Trump, run out the clock, is going to be the 2020 campaign slogan. That's a joke.
Thank you for explaining that.
The lawyers tell you if there's an ongoing conspiracy, you know, then you could slide the deadline there. But look, you know, I don't pretend to understand whether the Southern District of New York or Robert Mueller are going to try to indict the president. But I do understand from reading these court filings that everything this president touches is under investigation. He's under investigation. His White House is under investigation. His campaign is under investigation. His transition is under investigation. His inaugural committee is under investigation. The Trump Foundation, his charity, just entered an agreement with the New York State Attorney General today
to dissolve.
And the New York State Attorney General says it was a criminal enterprise that was self-serving and funneling money to members of the organization, which happened to be the entire Trump family.
Wait
that
a minute.
Is the organization,
he called
and supporting the presidential campaign.
He called it a criminal enterprise?
Yes.
Wow.
So, John, I'm embarrassed to acknowledge I don't know whether this is true or not, since I am theoretically a lawyer. One of the other things, you mentioned the whole statute of limitations on this campaign financing is running out before what would be a second term for Donald Trump ended, 2022. One of the things that Napolitano said in his interview with Shep Smith the other day, or yesterday, whenever it was that what prosecutors could do, and I'm curious now if you know this, if not, we'll check into it and talk about it more tomorrow, they could indict the president, seal the indictment, and not open it until the day he leaves office, assuming it's 2024. Have you heard anything about that other than out of Napolitano's mouth?
I mean, that's what our legal analysts say, that that's a possibility as well, that things could be filed and sealed and then unsealed when the president left office or if there was some change in Justice Department guidelines. So we'll see how that plays out. Marjorie, I just want to read the quote from you since I've made the Attorney General of New York State, Barbara Underwood, accused the foundation, said the foundation was guilty of, quote, a shocking pattern of illegality, willful and repeated violations that amounted to, quote, the Trump Foundation functioning as little more than a checkbook to serve Mr. Trump's business and political interests. And it goes on and on and on, but essentially saying that it was a sham set up to support him and his family and his politics.
You know, one other thing that happened today, the president's apparently changed his mind about the border wall. He was insisting upon getting the border wall, and there was all this talk about was it going to be a government shutdown. Now he's not going to insist upon the border wall funding.
Not clear. Sarah Sanders did an interview on Fox News in which she said that there are other ways to get that money, that if there's some money appropriated, maybe not the full $5 billion he wanted, that there are other ways to move money around. What exactly does she – they've said that in the past, mind you, so that in and of itself is not a new statement.
Yep.
She's about to brief at the White House. So we'll see. We checked this. Our Capitol Hill team checked this with people on Capitol Hill, and both Democrats and Republicans are scratching their heads. They don't know of any specific proposal from the White House or guidance from the White House that the president is prepared to retreat, or if he is prepared to retreat, what is he going to accept? What would he accept? Because let's assume the president realizes the votes are not there, because the votes are not there for his $5 billion in wall funding. If the president, if that has finally sunk in with the president, then the question is, what will he accept? That is more important than the president saying, okay, I get it, I'm not going to get all $5 billion. That's an important first step, but then you still have to, what will you accept and what will you sign? And we're having a conversation Tuesday, 1:35 p.m. here in the East, with a 5 o'clock Friday deadline or a midnight Friday deadline for about a quarter of the government to shut down.
You know, but John, just staying on the wall for a second, John King, is these are obviously, it's my characterization, not yours. It's one thing to suggest this absurd theory that Mexico is paying for the wall because of the savings from the renegotiated NAFTA, which, again, I assume there are three people somewhere who believe that. But as a matter of reality, while Trump has defied every single prediction that's been negative, it seems to me the one thing he would have a real hard time running for re-election without is some major progress on the wall. I mean, was there anything that was more central to his campaign and his campaign rallies in 2016 than building the wall and Mexico paying for it?
No. And so you raise an interesting question. The salvation for the president on that one might be that we don't, at the moment, don't see a credible Republican challenger, because that's much more of a base Republican issue.
That's a good point.
In the sense that the president won for two reasons. He won in the primaries by playing the immigration card first and foremost. And he was different, and he was an outsider, and the Republicans were clearly surprised us and were looking for something outside of the Republican box, if you will. But the immigration play was huge in the primaries. And then the trade and the economics were more important to Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. When he turned the blue states, he flipped to red. But to the point about achievements, what are you running on at a time when we're all scratching our heads and worried, whatever your politics, that the economy could tip in a recession or that we're about to have the worst December in forever for the markets, that if you don't have a strong economy to run on, what do you have? And you'd like to, whatever your issues, whatever it is, as a politician running for re-election, you'd like to say promises made, promises kept, whatever your promises were. Now he can say he cut taxes, and some people like that, some people don't, but that's a promise made and a promise kept. But on the wall, you're right. As of today, that is a promise made, and it is a promise, A, not kept, and B, to make the case that Mexico is going to pay for it would be like me trying to make the case the Patriots have had two great Sundays in a row.
The poor Patriots.
That dog won't hunt.
Shocking you squeezed that in there. Hey, Merry Christmas, John, to you and all of yours. We really love having you here, and we'll talk to you in the new year.
Thank you both. Thank you both and everybody listening. Have a safe, happy, merry.
Thank you very much, John King. John King joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Up next, it's Rest in Peace for the Weekly Standard. Alex Beam is here for his take on that. I feel very bad for them, actually. And his takedown of all gimmicky holiday gift ideas. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GVH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us, as he does every week, is Alex Beam. And as we do every single time Alex is here, we marvel that his name is Alex Beam. Because, and I think it was Marjorie who said that, one of our producers maybe said this morning, because Alex is writing like the Alex Graham Bell telephone is ring-a-ding-ding. Hi,
oh
Alex.
God.
How are you? Nice to
so
see
pathetic.
You.
It's so pathetic.
Thank
nice
you.
To see you both. Yes.
Really appreciate that.
That's really awful.
So we have a big announcement.
We do?
Yes, we do. Go
what
ahead,
is
Alex.
It? We do?
Well, we've landed on a book. A book shorter than Moby Dick.
Every book is shorter than Moby Dick.
For the Boston Public Radio Book Club. We're going to read the autobiography of Malcolm X, written by Alex Haley and, of course, also by Malcolm X. It's called an autobiography. It's a ghostwritten autobiography. Utterly fascinating book. And we're going to discuss it here on the air on Wednesday, February 26th at 1 o'clock, which gives everyone plenty of run-up
time.
It's neither an excessively long book nor an excessively short book. And as a lot of people listening know, a lot of it takes place here in Boston.
Why'd you pick
right,
it, by the way?
The dreaded local angle.
Did you pick
the
it for
dreaded
that?
Local
Did you pick it for that reason or no?
To be blunt, yes.
You did. Great.
And
I
also,
think great.
I mean, there's this whole, I don't want to, I mean, I actually really want to reread the Norfolk stuff. He was incarcerated at MCI Norfolk for a number of years. And it's actually where he had his, you know, sort of personal epiphany. So I believe we will read that it's where he learned to read. It's where he came to
Great
the Nation
choice.
Of Islam, et cetera. I'm really excited. Okay.
And by the way, as we well know, Alex Haley, when people saying I've heard of Alex Haley, if you haven't heard of him because of the autobiography, you've obviously heard of him because of Roots.
Roots.
So that's an excellent choice. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
February
26th well.
At 1 o'clock.
We're very excited about this.
Hey, speaking of books, before you continue for a second, I don't want to upset you if you were excluded, but after we did our Moby Dick, which was our last book, our Moby Dick thing, we had the mayor of New Bedford on, as you probably know, and the mayor of New Bedford said to us as well that there was a Moby Dick read-a-thon, which you may know, happens every year, where they read the whole book on January 5th at the Whaling Museum, I think, in New Bedford. We have been invited to read a chapter, as has Amanda McGowan, our colleague.
I know.
Have you?
You can't one-up me.
Have you?
On the air? Yes.
Oh, yes. And oh, this is going to be great.
I'm kind of
January
psyched.
5th.
Are you going the same day?
Saturday. Of course. It's a one-day.
What do you mean?
What, is he
going to
go
no.
another day
well,
and
I
read a chapter?
It's 24 hours.
Yeah, that's a legitimate question. Can we go down in a van? We should go down in the Moby van.
Absolutely.
Let's go down the Moby van.
We're not going.
I have a shocking
Oh, now he's not going to go at all. Now he learns I'm going.
Well, that is great. January 5th in New Bedford. Google it up. And you'll find out the Moby Dick 24-hour
reading. Scope out the
thing.
Restaurants.
I'm really
I'm super
excited
psyched.
About that,
All
by
All four
the way.
Of us are
yeah.
going.
So
New Bedford's
much.
A nice town.
It's going to
okay.
be great.
Yeah, it is going
to
be great.
All right. Okay, we're going to plug that to death.
Okay, so Alex Beam, what's your problem with Gmail finishing your sentences for you?
Smart Compose, right?
It's better than my wife finishing my sentences.
Yeah. I'm bummed. Thank you.
Okay.
What's
go
going
ahead.
On? What's going on with
well,
Gmail?
Well, explain what it is first, can you?
Okay. Well, I can... I'm one of those. Do you remember back when you had to be invited to use Gmail? Like only the cool kids. It was like by invitation only. Now everyone's sort of forced to use Gmail. I don't use it. However,
I don't use it either.
Okay, for the 8 billion people who do use Gmail, there's two sort of new algorithmic-driven software features called Google Compose and,
yes.
and Google Reply.
Yeah.
Which
I thought it was autocomplete.
Well,
what's that?
Well, that is what it is, essentially.
This is what it is, exactly. Yeah. But they've been given new names. And it's pretty easy to understand. It just turns out that when you're composing, say, an answer to an email, great to get your message. It says, plan to act on it shortly. In other words, Google will kind of read your mind, as it were, finish the email for you, thus, quote, unquote, saving you a lot of time. And so it functions both in a reply function and also in, like, I'd like to invite you to, and Google knows, of course, that you're having a party this weekend.
That's right.
So it fills it in and says, I'd like to invite you to my party this weekend, and so on and so on. The writer, I mean, a lot of people have written about this, and I apologize for forgetting exactly what article we all read. He makes an interesting point that actually...
Derek Thomas in The Atlantic.
Yeah, this actually adds to the time you spend working on your email because he suggests, I think correctly, that Google finishes your sentence for you and then you're disappointed with it. And so you need to write a better answer than Google writes. So you actually spend twice as much time composing your email thanks to Google Compose. Anyway, I don't use Gmail, but it sounds kind of inevitable, right? I mean, so I'm not particularly surprised.
But you don't know enough to know if the Smart Compose, does it personalize, for example, when whatever one uses, Twitter is a good example, when it finishes a word for you, that if you type the first few letters, you just click on it and the thing comes up, it accepts, I think Twitter does this, but I know some social media does, it words that only you use, it will incorporate into its... memory.
Exactly so, correct. Like my address, Bullo, like it knows now that I live at a place. So when I start typing B-U-L-L.
Exactly.
Exactly. Right.
So does Smart Compose do the same thing? If you have expressions.
But like times 100.
That you, oh, it does.
Like it, yeah. Like oh, okay. it knows your second wife's birthday or
okay,
something.
Fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, honey, sorry, I forgot
it's
you.
Creepy.
It just fills it in, you know, our anniversary that we've long forgotten or something.
You know,
yeah.
Someday, eventually, you can write the first line you two and it can finish your columns, too.
That's
which,
right. That's right.
Someday, my
we'll
friend.
Have your style
that
down.
Day has so arrived.
So Alex, I feel very bad about the Weekly Standard.
So do
I feel
actually.
Badly. I think I feel badly.
I feel bad because I got a check from them various times.
You did?
Yeah.
We're a really smart conservative magazine. Did a lot of politics there. Bill Kristol. They've not been a big fan of the president. I wonder how much that has figured into their demise, but is it just that it's a magazine and it's hard to keep them afloat these days?
I don't know. It's a complicated story. This was the week that the magazine founded by Fred Barnes, Bill Kristol, and financed by Rupert Murdoch, which a lot of people forgotten.
Yeah.
I think from 97 to 2009 or something, it was kind of this sort of a serious journal of opinion.
Yeah.
Had a good literary section among other things, and then basically Murdoch shunted it off to this guy, Philip Anschutz, who's a pretty big deal right-wing player in Washington, D.C., specifically with his kind of paper/website known as the Examiner.
Washington Examiner.
The Washington Examiner, precisely. And we learn in the journalism that accompanies the demise of the Weekly Standard that Anschutz is launching the Examiner magazine. And the cynics, who, as Russell Baker noted, are often right, feel that he basically wants to take the dwindling subscribership and readership of the Weekly Standard and forcibly merge it and sort of give his new magazine a bump. And yes, there's a political component to this. I mean, I hate to open a parenthesis about the utterly fascinating politics of Rupert Murdoch, but now I'll close that parenthesis. But the Weekly Standard was conservative but not Trumpist conservative, and Anschutz is much closer to Trumpets. Your previous guest would have some interesting views, is Trumpism becoming the sort of default standard of the Republican Party and of quote-unquote American conservatism? I'm not sure. But it is sure that this kind of once mainstream publication is out of gas for now.
Now, for you liberals who are listening saying, I'm not upset that it left at all, I would respectfully say you should be. And here's why. I think the most valuable publications who have a political bent are ones that have the courage to criticize their own. Liberals who criticize liberals. Not only did they take on Trump from time to time, they had the courage to take on, in my opinion, the most disgusting congressperson in America of 435. That's Steve King from Iowa.
Yeah.
They wrote a piece saying that he had called immigrants from Mexico dirt. He challenged them and said that's totally made up and that sort of thing. And what they did is they released the tape recording they had on which he referred to immigrants as dirt. And when Donald Trump, a Weekly Standard folded, he referred to them in a very loving way as pathetic and dishonest. Steve King followed up and said, real Donald Trump is right on the Weekly Standard's deserved demise, pathetic and dishonest. If the articles targeting me were redacted until only truth remained, there would not be much left to read. And then I can't remember who, but one of the leaders of the Weekly Standard responded to that tweet in a very balanced way, I thought, and said to Representative King, the stench of your deceit and your views pollutes your district, your state, your party, and the United States of America. That, to me, is why
I love that
magazines
kind of journalism.
Exist. So do I.
I can tell that you do.
But the point is, they were willing to criticize their own, which I not that Steve King is their own, but conservative politicians, which I think is critically important, obviously, in American politics.
So yeah, they were real. Although, I mean, I say, the failing New York Times really hasn't had as great an 18-month run as in the last 18 months that Donald Trump has been tweeting about.
I tell you, he's the best thing for subscriptions ever, isn't he?
He says that, exactly. By the way.
Every time he calls him the failing New York Times, their numbers go up and up and up. It's great. Keep saying it.
Exactly.
So, Alex, apparently you don't like a lot of things at Christmas time. You wrote an entire column about awful gift ideas. Some of them I'm embarrassed to say are things I purchased for some of the people on my...
The avocado socks, for instance?
Not avocado socks, but other things.
Well, we discussed it yesterday. One of the things he says, then you can describe more your piece here, don't enroll me in any of the month clubs, please.
Yeah.
What did we discuss yesterday, Margaret?
Well, a couple of years ago, I got Jim for Christmas the Salami of the Month Club subscription. And it was his favorite.
For only 6 months,
it was his favorite gift. Well, it's very expensive, Jim. It's very expensive. They're high quality salamis. That's right. And I thought that was his favorite gift.
Yeah,
he gave
that
me
exactly proves what I'm trying to get at.
Red
exactly. Yeah.
Red
so
Sox.
what are some of the examples? Tell us what you don't want. Not that anybody I know is planning on getting you anything.
I don't
assuming they were,
yeah.
What's on your not to do or not to give list?
Well, really everything when you get down to it. No books, no sweaters is an obvious default. Pacific bull kelp is on my acceptable list. So if you do want to, I will
yeah,
be accepting
I don't even know what that is.
Pacific bull kelp.
I don't know what it is either. What is it?
Pickles.
It's kelp. It's huge kelp, you know, made out there in, in the Pacific. Yeah.
What do you do with it, by the way?
Well, you can make pickles from it. I saw it in an airline flight magazine. But the thing that I used in the headline, of course, is that the Wall Street Journal, one of my favorite publications, actually kind of basically advertised in what was masquerading as a gift catalog idea, a toilet, a voice command toilet. And these are the
This is disgusting.
This is a literal term they use. They said you can DJ your defecations because there's a Bluetooth hookup to the toilet. So you can, like, play Yeah, I mean, it's nuts. However, I have learned that apparently in the future there's going to be a technology that will analyze your stool and diagnose you for cancer.
So glad you brought that up, by the way.
Yeah.
But putting aside that latest quality, when we went to that arts and crafts open house, when this old house people finished the house in Arlington. Hello, Marjorie.
Marjorie, we're over here.
Sorry. I was getting a message from our staff
about
fruitcakes.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Putting that aside just for a minute, sorry. You know this is live radio. You know that, right?
I do.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
I just want to be clear.
If I read it, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble.
I can't win. When we went to the, whatever they call it, the ribbon cutting or whatever, when this old house finished that beautiful house in Arlington?
Oh, my gosh, yes. That was fantastic.
What did they show us? They showed us one of these singing toilet things.
Oh, they did.
I don't think it analyzes your whatever.
No, but it was absolutely, you would just live your life in this bathroom. It had the radiant heat coming up from the floor. It had the heated towel racks, you know, you warm up your towels. The toilet was unbelievable.
Was it DJ? Could you
DJ
the toilet?
I believe the answer is yes.
You had
I'm
your
quite
playlist?
Sure
no,
it played all your songs on your iPad or iPod or whatever.
Why would you not want that for
Christmas,
by the way?
I'm going to share something with you, something unbelievably personal.
That's great.
So we were once given as a gift this thing that I think you can get at CVS. It hooks over your toilet, and as you get up at night, it lights up the commode. It perceives that you're nodding your head. You've heard of them?
I've seen them, late night television, as seen on TV.
Oh, you're
seen all the time.
They're fantastic. Yeah. I'm 100% shilling for them. They're great. It lights up your life.
So now, has anyone ever given you a Flowbee for Christmas? That wasn't on your list. You know what a Flowbee is?
I do not know what a Flowbee is.
Flowbee, which it's rather embarrassing that you do not know. A Flowbee, if you were to watch television late at night, is a haircutting device. That you attach, you're trying to save a few bucks, I assume, from time to time, right?
Generally
speaking. Right, So you attach it. Now, the problem with the Flowbee, which is not that expensive, it's like $30, is you do have to buy a canister vacuum cleaner for $400 to make it work. You attach the Flowbee to your vacuum cleaner. You decide whether you want your hair to be a half an inch, a quarter of an inch, whatever. You set the thing.
Yeah.
You put it on your
head. Sucks it right in there. Yeah.
And then it's got a blade in it, and it sucks your hair up, and it cuts your hair for you.
Does this explain your amazing tonsorial excellence?
Thank you.
Daily witnesses to here?
You honestly never heard of a Flowbee?
I really don't stay up.
That's because you're an elitist, actually, is what it is.
Well, maybe that, too.
Do you know what a Flowbee is?
Of course. You've talked about Flowbees for
even
years.
Even before I have talked about it. Do you know what a Flowbee was?
Not until you talked about it. I was not aware of
it. I like to go to the barber. It's very restful, frankly.
But I'm glad you can get Donald Trump chew toys for dogs.
I didn't mention you can also get Donald Trump toilet brushes.
Is that really? No, that is not true.
That is so true. It comes up in my Facebook feed like all the time.
It does really.
Yeah.
It's great.
Okay. This is something that Jim would like on his list. He would like a replica of his head.
Oh.
Please tell us.
Briefly, because we've got to get to the explainer.
Oh, really?
You have to be very quick. I'm sorry.
Well, it turns out, look, for a mere 10,000 euro, and that's as good as anyone's guess, I think it's about $12,000, there's a fabrication and society called, I think, Macarium or something in Milan, Italy, and they will do an exact replica
of your head.
Yeah, it's usually $25,000, but if your eyes and mouth are closed, they can bring it down to $10,000.
So they don't have to do the teeth. The teeth are expensive.
And I guess the general look. Yeah. Who knows about the hair? In any case, these showed up at like a Gucci fashion show.
Pretty weird.
Early in the year where models were actually carrying.
Holding their heads.
Creepy.
Very lifelike.
Yeah.
Replicas.
Creepy.
Okay, let me just tell you, nobody cares about that. Now let's get to the.
You have
little more than 45 seconds for a 45-second explainer. You write these into your phone? Is that what you do? And then you read the explainer?
No!
So why did you just open your phone?
Because I'm queuing my memory. That's
okay,
why.
So what is your explainer going to be today?
I want to celebrate the fact that the explainer is not the inverted yield curve, which
was huge
last week.
Great.
Yeah.
Big success.
What's the explainer this, this week is, was Jesus Christ actually born on December 25th?
That's a great one. That is a great
well,
one.
Well, that's why I'm
okay,
cueing the actual facts.
Give him 55 seconds for this, judges.
Okay,
go ahead.
We're ready.
Start. Go.
Okay. Well, I don't. I mean, obviously, the three of us want to stay on radio for another few weeks. So we're just going to say very gently that it's quite probable that Jesus Christ was not born on December 25th.
Wait, okay? That's it?
No, I'm going to give you some additional detail.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. I mean, the exact date of Jesus' birth is not specified in the Bible. It's possible you could make some bizarre astrological calculations. Don't get me started on that. Some people think that the evidence in the Bible might be that Jesus was actually born in the springtime because the shepherds were letting their flocks out to graze. Anyway, let's fast forward to the 4th century when Pope Julius firmly set December 25th, our calendar, not their calendar, as the birthday of Jesus Christ, basically for two reasons. I'm going to give a plug to one of your sponsors, Revels, basically to take the wind out of the Roman Saturnalia, and B, which occurred around the same time, huge festival, huge pagan festival, and B, there were a lot of Christianity was trying to push into Northern Europe, where the festival Yule, J-U-L, Yule, which is celebrated at the Cambridge Revels.
Of course.
Basically, it's the solstice, right? December 22nd, we all know. December 25th, you see the overlap. Okay, the big finish.
Please.
So we've always celebrated Christmas in or around December 25th, except in the 1670s, during Oliver Cromwell banned Christmas.
Judges, could you ring the thing soon?
No, it's getting more interesting.
Okay,
it's going to end very soon.
Okay,
please, I'm begging you not to.
Why Oliver Cromwell
10 seconds.
Ban it?
No, 10 seconds.
Because the strict Puritans banned the celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ. And guess who was ruling Boston in the late...
Mayor Curley.
Puritans? The bleeping Puritans.
The Puritans.
Christmas was banned in Boston in the 1680s.
Fabulous explanation.
That's your takeaway. We're happy to have it back.
Okay.
You're being sardonic, but
I don't know what that means. February 26th,
exactly.
Autobiography of
Christmas,
Malcolm X.
Should we go ahead next week?
Okay, good. Marjorie, move it.
Alex Beam joins every week. He's a columnist of the Boston Globe. His latest book is
The
Feud, Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and the End of a Beautiful Friendship.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Juliet Kayyem, Mueller Time, Harvard historian Nancy Kane, and former EPA head Gina McCarthy. What is on television? Please, Jim Bradley.
After a quarter of a century, two mistrials, a lot of time in jail, Sean Ellis, the prosecutor in Suffolk County, says they will not be pursuing. I think it's a fourth trial. Sean and two of his lawyers will join me tonight. Jimmy Tingle ran for lieutenant governor. He's got a great story to tell, great comedian, great soul. He's going to join me, and we're going to highlight this 15-year-old climate activist who is my newest hero. We'll do that tonight as well.
I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, our on-site engineer, Dave Goldstein. Special thanks to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe and to the people that came down to the Boston Public Library. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browning.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.